Well, trying to.
I think the majority were, you know, pro-Trump and just the love for him. He's the greatest president ever. He's recognizing us in the military and all this stuff. You know, they're really getting inflated. And then what, somebody yells a red wave because they're all worried about the blue wave's going to knock Trump out in November. But Trump says the red wave is bigger. So someone said that. But the emotion is pretty incredible. The military really felt that they were, you know, not being getting any supportive coverage for decades. Now, of course, this is the perfect cliche agenda of fascism, right? Trump, he supports, he says, I love the military, I love the war, I love the mob, I love mafia, I love everybody, I love all Americans. They're good people on all sides. Of course, the single-minded, literate lefty guys are, you know, in apoplectic seizures over this stuff, but I thought it was neat the way, yeah, go ahead.
I was out tonight for dinner, and CNN was on, and it was just, the titles, it's so ridiculous, the things they're talking about.
Yeah, like, that's what I was wondering. I think a lot of people, I saw that in the comments, a lot of people are seeing through that. They don't like the media anymore.
It's not the news. They're just talking. They're trying to find something on Trump. They're saying, did Trump really use the N-word? Did Trump do this? You know, old casino friend of Trump speaks out. Like, every single 20 minutes, there's a new thing that they're trying to come out with about trying to bash him.
Yeah, Amorosa. They can't wait for her to release all her tapes.
Even CNN called her out, and they said she's just looking for to make money. They even can even see it. Even on CNN.
Wow, that's incredible. Maybe they just throw it, but they don't stop trying to get tapes from her. They have to look like the balanced view. But it's just me in the White House. Everybody's always trying to figure out me. And if I was president, it'd be the same way. You know, I think Bob once swore. I think he claimed he fucked Susanna. You know, and he's married. And we got a tape of that in one of the shows. You know, they say that kind of shit about me all the time, right? If I was in the White House. So Trump's doing it for me.
Right.
I know.
And he's on the drops.
Amorosa as low life. She's a low life. She's a low life.
He is outrageous. He is violating all decorum of the presidential role. You know what I mean? He really is. I am predicted, the last president is Obama. Obviously, Trump is not president. He's ruining the institution. Yet, it's what a lot of people like. They don't want that priestly, secular religiosity around the White House anymore. It's been useless.
You still go by.
And it's interesting that Trump has gotten Twitter is the way he communicates to the American people.
Yeah.
And that's how people, they take his Twitter, they read them, and that's how they communicate. That's how the word is spread. And
that's how
like
he feels. They feel good.
Yeah, and then isn't that what Roosevelt did with the radio and the fireside chats that connected him directly to the people that
Here's an important point, Susanna.
Radio.
Listen, here's the important point. McLuhan says in Understanding Media that the key to Roosevelt's success was he encouraged the newspaper, which was a powerful medium back there, to be all mad at him. So then he looked like he was embattled, and the people sort of, you know, identified, the American nature identifies with the little guy, so he'd come on and do the radio by himself, and then he'd counter the negative stuff coming from the hot newspaper, and that's where he got his charisma. So Trump's doing the same thing. He's encouraging the TV body to scream and yell at him so he can look Rooseveltian through his singular solo Twittering.
Right. Speaking one-on-one almost to the people.
Yeah, he gives a one-on-one thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because the literate American hates the mob. Even though they've become more and more mob under electric conditions, the basic individualist American character is holds on to the Clint Eastwood model and the strong, silent type, lousy conversationalist, and the that's the archetype that the Americans, that's what they're voting for. And so Trump wins on that level. But I've read every tweet by Trump since he got elected, and they are ridiculous. He just says, oh, I met with the Boy Scouts today, great people, and then he meets with every politician, every prime minister from every shithole is a wonderful person, they're great friends. It's the most, you know, placid, banal statements, but I like reading them. And I'm saying, yeah, this is what the people like. Here's a guy with a rosy attitude, but every now and then, to show he's practical, he says, those assholes over there, the fake news media, ignore them. They're liars. I've done all this good stuff, and they don't say one word about it. You know, so he downs down with that.
He says that.
That's right. He says he's not even typing this stuff anymore. It's automatic. You know, it's the Android media. They got the script. But I find it interesting to read it, just to have it there. He's actually, you know, it's just never happened before, a president talking like that. So he's invented a new way to be president. And they like to say he has his base, but I think he has a resonance beyond the base, you know?
Mm-hmm. And you know what's interesting? I just saw this documentary, not documentary, this show about the Malachi, St. Malachi's prophecy. Are you familiar
yes.
with that? And,
well, the Malachi is the writer, isn't he?
Well, he was a monk in Ireland. In the, I don't know, 400, 300.
Oh, okay.
Like
right.
And he did a pilgrimage to the Vatican, to Rome, and right before he was looking down at Rome, and he had this vision, and he wrote down what the vision was. He didn't quite, I don't know if he ever explain what the vision was, but one of the things he did was this list of all the popes, but it was a cryptic way of describing them. They compare it to the way Nostradamus wrote, and it was a cryptic, like, one-sentence phrase that would describe every pope. And it's been what he's written has correlated to the actual popes that have occurred throughout history, and they say that Pope Francis is the last pope. And that he's called, and according to the list, that Pope Francis would be the last pope.
Okay, so you know what? And now, that's interesting, but the Everine said 25 years ago to me that the last pope would be called Peter, because it began with Peter. So mm-hmm. we'll see if that happens.
Well, that's what St. Malachi wrote, is Peter of Rome. That's what the description calls the pope, Peter of Rome.
So Saint Francis, the president, or Francis, Pope Francis today, it fits the name Peter of Rome.
What they were saying, that Francis took the Francis of Assisi name, and that Saint Francis of Assisi had the name Peter as well. So
they're putting the two together, saying Peter, this guy is the fulfillment of the Peter prophecy.
That's what they're saying. But what
yeah.
I find more interesting, as they were describing the whole thing where the Pope before Francis, I forget his name, that he resigned, it's never been, it's unprecedented, that there's been popes that have been killed or assassinated but never resigned.
Right.
So that was a weird thing that they never really resolved in this thing that I was watching. But what they found interesting was how Francis was the total antithesis of what a pope was and normally
yeah.
is. He's totally, he's just redesigned, he's not following the papal norm in what he's saying should be done in the church, in how he acts as pope. He rides around in a little car, and, you know, he's just totally different. He doesn't have any of the prominent circumstances of the pope. He has no security, and he's revamping doctrine, religious doctrine, and creating a huge division within the church. And something
yeah.
I'm listening to this, I'm like, my God, that's like Trump in the presidency, turning
yes.
that topsy-turvy, and so is Francis.
Only he's liberal,
pope-friendly.
What? He's the consolation for all the alt-liberal ethos out in the world that hate Trump. At least they can look to the Vatican City and be like, oh yeah, oh thank God, and then they can just
yeah, he's a nice guy.
Deep breath.
He's a nice
yeah.
liberal. Now, you may not know this, Rich, but I am predicted all this, and JW and I went to the Vatican in August 2011, and they took us down. They knew JW was wealthy, and they took us down to the secret part of the Vatican and offered JW, you know, these artifacts because they're bankrupt. They've been bankrupt for like 10 years or something. And they were trying to get some money, and they're hoping JW would buy something. So at one point, JW says, well, I want to look at room 32B or something like that. And the cardinal that was showing us around was shocked because no one knew that secret room. But Ion came through JW and said that. JW didn't know it, but Ion did. So we figured that out later. So they went and showed us the real secret stuff. And JW got to look at it, and I was all nice, but he told me later, I never intended to buy anything from them. I'm all for them going bankrupt. So they have been in trouble ever since. That's why that previous pope was called Sebastian. He had a strange name. He was actually Cardinal Ratzinger. He was the head of propaganda in the 80s and 90s, and a very right-wing guy, and he became Pope Sebastian, or whatever his name was, right? And before the present pope. So he quit because it was over. Ion said it was hopeless, you know, 5-7 years ago. There's nothing there. They haven't got any money. They can't raise any money. They had a couple of global priest conferences that didn't work. So that's why the guy quit. He said, this is useless. We're not doing anything. I can't take this. And he was a very strong mind.
Benedict.
Ratzinger, you know.
Not Sebastian. Benedict. The 16th.
You couldn't remember.
Who the fuck is Pope Sebastian?
Well, I just knew it was an ancient name that I don't regularly get to pronounce. So Sebastian. I don't know where I got that from. So, Benedict gave up. He said, this is no fun. There's not even any intellectual challenge here. And then they put in the Joker Pope.
Yeah. Well, what about, like, I always thought that Vatican II is what ruined the Catholic Church, right? Where people could start actually hearing what they were saying in their own language? I mean, like, come on. There goes all
That's
the
right. McLuhan wrote about that, you know. He said, the mystery of the oral massage was gone. And you get into Protestant semantic meaning, you're screwed.
Yeah, and that's like all the Catholicism had up until then was the fact that people didn't actually need to listen to the words being said.
Right.
So, I mean, like,
and also
like
McLuhan said the microphone wasn't good. He wrote an essay in 71 about the bad effects of Vatican II, and especially the microphone and the English, putting it in non-Latin. Yeah, it was a big mistake.
Oh.
Did you know McLuhan said that, Rich?
No, but it's interesting because my mom got a part in a conference somewhere in Germany where she is giving a talk on the past 100 years of recording technology and how the recording technology itself has affected the way music and sound is perceived. And she's debating whether or not she should bother making the trip to talk about something that's not completely related to her work. But that is definitely on topic of what the talk would be about if she does end up going. So if you talk to her, talk to her about that.
Right. And is she going to Berlin?
No. It's, where is it? I don't know. Some small town. Somewhere with a university, you know. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's like in the south.
Yeah. Well, you know, if he's been invited there, you should do it, even though it might be a pain because something wants you there, and you never know what interesting, unrelated things will happen. Apparently unrelated.
Yeah, good point. Right.
You know, if someone actually invites you something, you should be polite and take up the invitation.
Well,
they're going to pay
applied.
You.
They applied.
Oh, okay. Well,
they applied
you,
and yes.
Okay, so we were talking about
Susanna
and
why
the
mentioned it.
Right.
The Pope turning the Pope
the Pope
to
McLuhan,
the like
Vatican II.
Trump,
right.
Trump, similarities between Francis and Trump.
Yes.
And then you were
well, the Queen was out of character. She said that she was going to quit, or this with a news item a couple months ago. She was going to quit and Phil, Charles would become king. Ion says that Charles will never become king. So it'd be interesting to see what happens there. But is that the queen getting purposeless too? She didn't want to go around and talk to people in her Commonwealth role. She'd rather listen to our show and take the drops. You know, people become antisocial.
Is it that she has to, as part of protocol, name him as the next king? Or is she really going to step down before she dies? And
well, that's a good question. I don't know the rules, but maybe that's why she did it. She had to say it, because she looked old.
She looked old.
Yeah, people, they think she's old. They don't know. They can't see her insides or her 144,000 double helix strands. They can't see that.
Yeah, so, I don't know what the protocol is.
So, Madeline, did you want to say anything, Madeline?
No,
there's
not really.
There's a lot of QAnon mainstream publicity happening.
Yeah, there needs to be.
Well, what is he saying now? What is QAnon saying?
Oh, well, the interesting thing is that plane that went down with the suicidal airport worker stole a plane and went joyriding and
yes.
crashed it. So that crashed into a very interesting island that has, like, 17 people live on it. And it has street names like Sandy Hook and Possession Point, and they're all the names are really freaking weird. And
yeah.
Supposedly, I think it, like they were launching missiles out of there. It seems to be a little bit of a deep state hive, and
right.
they crashed the plane right into that island or just off it. And the theory is Q has not come out and said this, but that they were blowing up that base and crashed the plane to sort of explain the fire.
Oh yeah.
Who is they?
And
maybe
they think,
who?
I don't know, our military. And that suicidal guy was probably an operative. Because if you listen to the recordings, he's super casual. And
yes.
and pilots are saying there is no way that was his. He was definitely a pilot. He was pretending not to know how to fly it, but he executed maneuvers that
right.
that only a pilot could do. Oh, and the flight path that he took, when you look at it on a satellite thing, it's a Q. He drew the shape of a Q with his plane.
Right. And I heard of that. Did someone say there were Qs on the plane?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, there's actually a shitload of coincidences with that. The Serial Brain does the gematria on it, and everything adds up to this deep, or, you know, white hat versus deep state operation. But then there's other stuff with the names, like the guy's name is also the name of a decommissioned submarine that was in some famous battle or something, or a plane, I forget what. But there's, like, so many little details that all add up to a very different story than what was presented in the media.
Right, and this guy, when he crashed the plane, he died?
Yeah, the plane was a Q. Well, that's what they're saying.
Yeah. Well, I posted that from some other site, and someone was talking about Colin Moore, Colin Harris Moore, some kid who years ago kept stealing planes and robbing people, and he became an internet hero. You guys ever heard of that phenomenon? So this present guy reminded the poster of the kid hero who eventually got caught and put in jail, but he maybe still an internet hero, but everybody used to like him because he would do crimes and get away with it, and he would steal planes, and even though he couldn't fly, and fly them around for a while, and land them, and run away. And he finally got caught down in the Bahamas in a boat. I had never heard of that phenomenon. But, well, why does that make you laugh?
I don't know. Because it's sort of absurd and it's rogue. I don't know. It's not what you're supposed to do. That's always entertaining. No, the guy that stole all the planets.
Yeah, and he became. People liked it. Yeah, the guy was saying the poster. This is on the McLuhan site. He said, "We all live empty lives. We're all economic slaves. There's no meaning, no purposefulness, and so anybody who attempts an escape, you know, becomes a hero. And so that's why this kid became famous, because people liked his attempt to be like a Trump, you know, just say fuck you and start stealing things and just playing,
yeah,
living the high life.
Yeah, very dramatic playing.
Yeah." Does that make anybody else respond? Susanna, Rich, Jeff, Anonymous, the other Anonymous? Maybe we should let Sarah speak. Should we let Sarah speak? Let's see how long she can keep a coherent sentence before we have to mute her. Okay?
Yep.
We're going to study Sarah. Okay, Sarah, you're unmuted. You have your hand up. That means you want to say something. Go ahead.
Oh, I don't know. Just thinking about Jack Parsons. Marvel.
Oh, I forgot to keep up with that. I'm about
John Jack.
Mind on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also I was thinking about John F. Kennedy and his son. And his son flew planes, right? Correct?
Yeah.
And his son was a publisher, correct?
Yeah.
Did publications?
George.
That kind of looks like
it.
That's a neat. The symbol, the G in the corner, is kind of a cool logo.
Right. It's funny you're doing that. I'm reading a book on the Kennedys, the latest guy who does a good inventory of all the different Kennedy assassination researchers. And so I was just reading that the last 24 hours. I bought it, and. He's the guy who's put out a Kindle book showing all the amazing new documents that Trump released on the Kennedy assassination. And he made a Kindle of that. And it's really interesting. What?
Why does Trump have certain things? Who was his dad?
His dad was mafia. It had to be. He's a construction industry, so he had to deal with the mafia. And Rosenbaum, who hates Trump, he's a Village Voice, longtime journalist. He writes. He's a good writer. He's going nuts. Been going on in his tweeting, nutting, going on about Trump because you know he grew up on the Trump world, and he just yesterday posted. A picture of Trump with Roy Cohen.
Roy Cohen, yeah. Yeah.
Some other guy.
That was where I was going next.
And so he's going on about Trump's mob connections. And Roy Cohen is considered one of the people involved in the Kennedy assassination. So it was all coming together this past 24 hours, reading about Kennedy. And there's this very good video of Roger Craig, a policeman who got nailed down there in Dallas, for trying to be honest about what was going on. And this book is a good inventory of all the different books. There's 600 books now on the Kennedy assassination. And so listen, Sarah. So 2003, he put out this book, and he finished doing the Kennedy assassination after he did that book. But then Trump released these files, and he just couldn't stay away, so he read all 50,000 documents and put together some important things. And on the Kennedy stuff, you should listen to it that we did on Saturday. Hey, you want to stop moving? Whatever, who's ever moving their stuff? You're creating background noise.
Want you to know I'm muted. That's not me.
Right. How come we muted?
It was me. I'm muting.
Oh, okay, good. So you listen to what JFK, what Ian says about JFK assassination on our last Bob's Private Session. I'd forgotten what Ian had said. It was way back in 2010. But he, Ian talks about how Oswald met with his CIA people a couple weeks before the assassination in Dallas, and he wasn't aware that they were already planning one in Chicago where they weren't going to use Oswald. But this thing where Oswald is meeting with his superiors about what to do next, that's one of the new items that's come out. A letter by Oswald to Mr. Hunt in a couple weeks before November 22nd, where he writes, he says, sir, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be doing. What are the instructions? When do I shoot Kennedy? But he doesn't say that. But it's implied that he has a role, but they're not talking to him enough to give him the details. And that's exactly what Ian said was going on with Oswald in 2010. So I read that. I discovered this guy a few months ago, read that part, that letter, because he has a video out. His name is... I want to look it up. He is Jerry Croth, K-R-O-T-H. Anyways, he has a pretty good video summarizing the Trump stuff. But there it is, what Ian said about Trump, about Oswald running around a few weeks before being confused. And so they can't figure out, is this Mr. H.L. Hunt, the silver wealthy guy in Dallas, because he was an extreme right-winger, or is it E. Howard Hunt, the CIA agent, who was in Watergate, caused the Watergate thing? So the author, Croth, decides it is E. Howard Hunt, because E. Howard Hunt released on his deathbed a confession of how he was involved with the Kennedy assassination for his son, but he didn't tell the exact details that he did, because then his son would have gotten in trouble knowing it. So it had a nice resonance with the Mafia and JFK assassination and Ian. And then I saw, well, you saw, Sarah, the mob connections to Trump. So Trump is exactly the church subgenius. J.R. Bob Dobbs infiltrates the conspiracy. You know, he has to be a bit of an asshole. His father has to have the connection.
Put on whatever it takes.
Yeah, and he gets in there, and then he starts doing stuff that pisses off everybody of the old establishment. But his father was in construction, so they always had to deal with the mafia, because the mafia runs American cities. But his other uncle, the father's brother, was a nuclear physicist in charge of the Tesla archive. So you've got both aspects
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get too loud, but that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about. Is that hasn't always been common knowledge about Trump of being bequeathed those Tesla papers, right?
No, nobody talked about it until recently. Nobody talked about Trump until recently. But this guy... John Trump, you know, his mafia father's brother, I guess he left town and got educated, but he was the understudy of Vannevar Bush, who wrote the first Internet Manifesto in 1945. He was like the top scientist up there with Oppenheimer for the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb, and he went on to be the leader of all kinds of developments in science for the American government.
Yep.
You know that name?
Oh, yeah. Vannevar Bush.
Last 30 years, however he lived. But his right-hand man and understudy and the next guy to take over was Trump's uncle. So the top scientist, grew and nurtured Trump's uncle. That's pretty incredible.
And I said bequeathed for a reason, because I'm assuming that then Trump has obtained these documents. But I assume that this is an heirloom or mafia-based tradition handed down.
Trump knows. Ian told us, and I've told you guys this before, that when he was young, he drank a lot. And he had a vision, or something happened to him while he was drinking. He went into a parallel world, and all this weird stuff happened to him. And he came out of it and was frightened by it, and so he gave up drink. But he started to explore the alternative stuff. He did a Dobbs, you know. He started looking into alternative stuff, going off the grid. And that's why he ends up during his campaign talking to someone like Alex Jones. He is naturally interested in the fringe perspective.
Oh, wow.
Sounds like the mayor of Casterbridge story.
So Trump did drink at one point, you're saying?
Yes, and he had this weird psychedelic experience or whatever happened to him, and he spent his life investigating what the hell happened to him, and he also stopped drinking because he didn't like the experience. But he intellectually has probed it, and like he's like a sub-genius. He's Bob in the White House. He's much like me, as Ion says. I mean, if I was president, you know, I'd call up, who would I call up? I'd call up Clinton. I'd say, hey, Clinton, what's happening with your McLuhan studies there, where the people need to know, you know? Or I'd call up Sarah and find out how Kiki's doing. And they'd say, Bob,
find out how I'm,
our president how is fucked up, man. Look at him. And then they'd say, well, did you fuck Susanna? I said, no, I just said I was discarnate. When you're on the radio, you're electrified, you're inside everybody's body. I fucked anybody who was listening to the show metaphysically. I'm inside a vagina. That's what happens under electronic conditions. Read McLuhan's review of William Burroughs in 1964, December 64 issue of Nation magazine. Can you imagine me as president? I'd be citing and quoting, read Bilderberger letter, May 14, 69.
Page 246.
The American Psychiatric Association format.
Yeah, read page 246 in the media simplex. That's what we're up against here. I can't tell who the Android meme is anymore.
Wow.
People think they're offended now.
Say,
can you imagine?
Wasn't there a similar story about George W. Bush as well, about
yes.
him drinking heavily, and then all
well,
of a sudden he stopped because he had
yeah.
a religious experience. Of
he
some
did.
Sort.
He went fundamentalist, and now he just paints pictures of popes and Dalai Lamas.
No, he paints really radical pictures, though. He doesn't paint poops.
See, he was the early, he was the early version of Trump, because the internet collapsed in 2000, which was the Android meme, and so the after image was going through its first death. We could be homeopathically retrieved with Web 2.0, but during the election campaign in 2000, he knew that people were sick of information overload. So in the debates, all he'd do when Gore was going on about how he invented the internet and he's the important guy in the information society, all George Bush II would do would wink at the audience. He used nonverbal communication. And then would say, I don't read the newspapers, I don't watch TV. He showed the preference of not being involved in the information society. That's what his charisma is. And now Trump's doing the same Bush thing and Reagan, but in reverse and quadriphenically more complex, because it's a way different media environment today.
Hmm. Well, was that what, what's-her-face, McCabe's vice? What's her name? The Alaska, the governor from Alaska?
Oh, Palin.
Was she,
or Palin.
Palin. Was she going the same route, being disconnected from the media in that way? Or so that,
well, did
mean,
you,
says, come on.
Yeah, did you see my post on the New Explorations group? I'm arguing with somebody. Oh, I announced that Madonna is so appropriate. What happened to her, I predicted it, you know, 23 years ago. I put Madonna in the Dobbs quadrant. Why? Well, I don't know. I felt that she was an Android meme musician. She's not singing to you. And so I said, hey, look, here it is. She's 60 years old, and they're promoting her as a great anti-aging starlet. You know, like she's doing the Dobbstown no-aging thing. So she was the right one for me to pick 23 years ago for her generation of stars. So people came on saying, she's lousy singer. I prefer Cher or Jane Fonda. And so people were putting down Madonna. And I point out to them, look, you people are showing how you don't understand the Android meme. She is the Android meme's music. She ain't singing to you, just like the Android meme's not talking to you. You don't judge her by her quality. She's on a whole different other level. But the important point is that she's mirroring the Dobbs quadrant, which is known for to be non-aging.
You know what she is? She's an endurance artist.
Yeah.
She's not, or an athlete, really.
Yeah.
That's very... Bob,
that's what I did. I started punk in 75 by doing push-ups.
That's not what Frank Zappa said. He said that it started by this guy realizing in England, because it always starts in England, he says. When you tell the story of when punk started, you always have to start that it starts in England, according to Frank.
Yeah.
And some guy realized,
American culture.
Some really smart guy realized that to really get a certain type of music to catch on, you needed to have clothing that went with your affiliation to that music. So he had a couple of guys put safety pins in their face. And then
yeah, that's
he
Malcolm
had
McDowell.
A boutique.
Not Malcolm McDowell, Malcolm, whatever his name is.
Well, you think he was telling a real story then?
No. Okay,
I'm telling you what.
Wait.
Yeah,
listen,
Zappa.
Here's the thing. I'd like to see where Zappa said this, but it sounds familiar. He does talk about clothing, but that's what McLuhan said way back in the 50s. You know, rock and roll is not music. Teenage music is not music. It's an environment. That's why all the Hip Parader and teen magazines would ask you, what do you eat, what's your favorite this, what's your favorite color, all this non-musical information, because teen music was the mixed media environment. It wasn't music that Stravinsky was making or the jazz guys were making. And so it's always been a mixed media environment, a pop star, okay? So,
well, listen to this.
Zappa was aware of that.
Yes, so, he was. So and they tried to probe him, like, okay, Dick Cavett tried to lead him into discrediting Elvis Presley in some way. So
is
he
right?
just start. Yes. So he, like, laid it out for Zappa to say something negative about him. And Zappa's response was, well, I have never been a fan of rockabilly. I've always preferred
to. Well, you know why?
Like, and I,
here's what, let me tell you.
But
what
I think that's a great answer. That's a great answer because they tried to get him to do a personal
response. No, he was cool, but he would just not tell his biography because in high school, 1955, he loved the movie The Blackboard Jungle. He had a normal teen reaction to that. He said, it was our world, our music put into movies. And the kids had never seen themselves in movies in that way. There might have been youth movies, but not their culture. You know, Bill Hale in the Comets and Blackboard Jungle. So he said everybody was leaping in the theater. That was great. And he understood the power of, you know, of a peer group identifying with something. But then he said because he got into black R&B or what was it called, race music or something, the kids, the tactility effect of television and the computers required a new raw tactile music, which jazz wasn't meeting. It was too hot radio slick. So
specifically
became an expert on black music, okay, as a teenager. And then he formed an integrated band and was beat up a lot for that. But the point is, when Elvis came out, here's this kid who's been listening to Gatemouth Brown and Muddy Waters and every other great black musician, blues guys. He said Elvis sounded like a cartoon. It was a white guy trying to sound black. And for the white kids, they didn't hear the race music, and so that was powerful. Elvis's Cheese Whiz version of the black music was powerful for the white kids, but they didn't have the sensory training that Zappa had.
I've always heard
an interview of Elvis recently too, and he ends up answering a question with the words that if somebody wrote a song like that, he would certainly sing it, but no one writes songs good enough for him to do another song. So he didn't write his own music. That blew me away. For him to be such an icon as a song singer, for his lyrics to be so everlasting and the iconic Americana, it's strange to me that he didn't write his own words.
Well, he was grew up in played in the era in the 50s when the record companies had writers.
Yeah.
Yeah, singles, 45. Right.
You can listen to, I met a guy here who was one of those people in New York in the 50s and 60s, Matt somebody. Just look at my list on Dobbsound.com. Go down, look at Matt somebody, the guy that lives here. So he explained what it was like in the 50s making music for teenagers. That was like the lyrical Wrecking Crew. Then in the 60s, the Wrecking Crew were
the Beatles destroyed it. The Beatles by being performers who also wrote their own stuff created the modern band. Before that, like the local band would play
what
was written by
the. They didn't write the stuff right away, but they were inspired by Dylan. Dylan started it.
Dylan, yes, but Dylan had a terrible voice. So it was Dylan and then the Beatles who upset the idea of there being songwriters as a paid profession, and then the local band would play it. So there's Beatles songs that are being played by like six different bands. The local band would play the same song, and the Beatles were one of the bands playing the pre-written music, right?
So what you have there in the 50s is still a literate society, so you have the individual solo singer That's Elvis. But now we become software communists by the early 60s, so the kids are into communalism, and so you get four Elvises known as the Beatles. You have a group collective singing. That was part of their charisma.
Yes.
And they wear JCPenney Sunday vests at all times.
Right. And they had odd caveman haircuts.
Yeah, they did.
Putting on the audience of Liverpool.
Right. Okay, but back to Elvis. So Elvis plays his Cheese Whiz version, but he is popular because his manager was looking at Sun Records, not his manager, but the guy who ran Sun Records. They were looking for a white guy who could do black music. And it had to be a nice, clean white guy, and a cute guy, who would do a watered-down version. They tried to get Pat Boone, and he was just too white. He didn't have the raunchy hip swinging that Elvis had. So Elvis became the icon for this necessary, as McLuhan said, the South is retrieved under TV conditions. That's why every president pretty well after Eisenhower is from the South, or after Kennedy. That's why McLuhan said they had to kill Kennedy because he was too much from the North. And so they brought in the Southern guy, LBJ and Nixon and Carter and everybody at Reagan. They're all from the Southern United States. So the South was taking over. So McLuhan actually said in 64, Mae Bressel would have been really pissed off at him. He says, there's no conspiracy. It's just the South has the rhythms that meets the new tactile qualities of a TV world. And that's why rock and roll came in. But it was a programmed, you know, watered-down thing for white teenagers, literate teenagers, and Zappa could not respond to that. So he went off into his own unique classical blues mixture. And plus his subgenius sensibility. Then he found out really good sociological stuff when I started talking to him. So that's why Zappa is the greatest. But he said that Elvis, out of the blue in 1970, and that's about the time Zappa was quite iconic in the media, he got a Christmas card from Elvis. And he kind of laughed about it. He said, I don't even know the guy, but he sent me a Christmas card.
Aww.
Yep, so Elvis yep. Another pointed evasion of what's your religion, Frank? Because they were also right. he kept getting probed with a Catholic can make a Catholic joke, but you know maybe if you were Jewish, it would be less of an issue for you to write the song you wrote about Sarah in the future, in the past.
Right.
You know,
your little princess.
Let me respond to that, Sarah.
Yeah.
So
that's my name.
So Elvis is reaching out to Zappa. He's having an identity crisis. He's totally obsolete. He'd gone to Las Vegas in 68, kind of got his image back, but he knows that's not good enough. He can't rely on the past, his own past image. So he's reaching out. So he sends a card to Zappa. So Zappa doesn't respond. And Zappa's the head of the counterculture. So he then goes to the White House and joins Nixon's anti-drug world. And he becomes the right winger.
That's a lasting.
Zappa. This is where Zappa's the influence behind everything. Elvis became a Nazi for Nixon because Zappa rejected him.
You're probably right, Bob.
Probably right.
Probably. Yep. I think he was really sick, but I always thought he was sick the same way that John F. Kennedy was sick.
Yes. I mean, they were so conflicted. They were old-fashioned people. You know, John Kennedy was a Catholic kid. His father was alcoholic. They were all drinkers because they were bootleggers. But he was trying to, just like Al Pacino in Godfather 3, trying to get the family's image out of the muck. And that's what Ian talks about, the parallel between Prince Philip dealing with Queen Elizabeth's second image is the same as problem JFK was trying to get out of the mafia image he had. So now Elvis is a proper kid. He's got all these girls thrown at him, but he's trying to be a proper kid and have a girlfriend. And there's all interesting movies on the girlfriend he had in the early years. You ever seen that one? That's what happened to her?
She's like 14.
No, what? What happened to her?
Well, they had a sincere relationship for a couple of years, but then Elvis goes off to Hollywood, and he just can't stop the adulation, and it kind of he becomes discarnate, super angel. He's not human anymore, and his girlfriend gets alienated. She just can't hang out with him. You know, he's too ridiculous in this new effect. So he's been killed and hijacked, for MK Ultra and the Global Theater. The same thing. Okay, so what was I going to say? Elvis did that.
He goes into, like, Frank Zappa went into this thing about, on the interview I watched today with Dick Cavett. He goes into.
I don't think I've seen that in a long time.
I watched it through something I have a subscription to, but I can send you a link of it.
Yeah.
He talked about why he doesn't use drugs, and
yeah.
it was really sincere, really, really yeah. sincere, the way that he spoke about how it just doesn't make sense to him and stuff like that. But I forget why
everybody
exactly.
Said, you know what, Sarah? Everybody thought he had done drugs because he made albums that mimed the drug trip.
That's what it was. He said Dick Cavett said, oh, have you lost people? Have people died or overdosed around you? And, you know, another bait to get, are you surrounded
yeah.
by junkies? And Frank was like, no, I've not lost anyone to death, but I've seen too many people have trouble with their shoes and not be able to speak the language anymore.
Yeah.
And I just thought, man, this guy is, like, infallible.
Sarah, I got that. So Roxy was saying Saturday night that Zappa was the perfect rebel, lined up with LaRouche's idea that, okay, this drug thing is going to take over and ruin kids. So he was anti-drugs. He had the right stance there, even though he's very unpopular for it. He was a businessman. He did all these different things, which he was the perfect anti-environment to everything. And you can see, you bring up all these different points. So in 1970, when... Hendrix died like in September, and Janis Joplin died like a month later, in the fall of 70. And Zappa is interviewed by CBC, very interesting interview I saw at the time, and he's doing smoke rings in a dark environment, and there's these smoke rings going up while the CBC guy is trying to, you know, get Zappa to say something. So he was might have said partly what he said there is drugs is not good. Look what happened to my friends, Jimmy and Janis. And they said, do you think there was a conspiracy or something? He said, no. They just, got nailed by the drugs they were taking. So he always had things to say about whatever was going on, and it always was completely different from what everybody else was saying, as you saw in the Dick Cavett thing.
Mm-hmm. He also, I noticed, Dick Cavett went to great length to avoid eye contact with every angle of every camera that was on him as the host.
Well,
but
he
Frank
was. When you're with Zappa, he had a weird vibe that comes out of his eyes. He has a picture of himself on the second album with the cosmic Luciferian spiral, hypnotic spiral coming out of his eyes. He even seemed to know that he did that, because Casey, when I'd look at him, you'd have to look away because this weird spiral come out of his eyes. You know, at that
that's
time,
what I was,
like, guy's not human. He's an ET or something, you know?
Well, he was breaking the fourth wall. He was just looking direct. Like, Frank would look directly
yeah.
into the camera and wink and be like, yeah, let's get this Jewish princess song problem out of the way. Do you
yeah.
think you have those lyrics on you? And then, like, Dick Cavett's like, I think I might. And he reaches into his pocket, pulls out a paper with the lyrics on it.
Yeah,
no.
yeah.
But he's
well,
the whole time Dick Cavett
line.
doesn't look at the cameras. He's acting like this is a private conversation.
Yeah. He loses.
But there's also a live audience.
So Zappa, when he did the song on making fun of Catholic Jewish girls, he said, I want a Jewish princess. The ADL, the Jewish thought police, basically tried to sue him. And he said, I'm not being anti-Semitic. Listen to this. He says, I'm not being anti-Semitic. I say, I want a Jewish princess.
Yeah, he says, I talked to a Jewish princess, and she said it's
yeah,
true. And I've always, like, I didn't know any of this claim about it. I didn't even know it was controversial. I just always thought, oh, he loves me. He wrote this song about me. How could he have known to do that so many years before I was born?
Are you Jewish, Sarah?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Well,
it's a weird
Bob.
I always
yes,
say that I am.
In retrospect, yes, you were Jewish. I can now see it. Yes, in retrospect. How do you guys tell that, Susanna? You know, hey, I better go over and check, see who's got muted. But anyways, I got to Zappa was always, that's what was so great about Zappa. You know, that's why I studied him at the time, because he was always interesting in his interviews. Like when Star Wars happened, he goes on Johnny Carson in the early 80s, and everybody's freaked out about Reagan's Star Wars, and Zappa just says, well, it's not going to work. How is it going to fight bacteriological warfare or biological warfare? And Johnny Carson goes, holy cow, that's incredible, Frank. Yeah, that's right. What is Star Wars? How's that going to protect us from, you know, AIDS virus? So he always had a good idea about everything.
Here's an idea that I have about Judaism. Think that maybe being Jewish is like a Persian influence, and the idea that there's a Jewish princess is based on that there's a Persian empire, and then yeah. Zionism, or that fraction deciding that that's different than Judaism somehow, it would be Queen's English British influence of a distinction of Protestant and Catholics.
Yes.
So
well,
really there's not...
The Arabs never forget, and the Israelis never remember, because literate societies don't remember. Tribal societies do. So the Jews are the phonetic alphabet. They're visual space in extreme. So they're focusing their mind on having a territory somewhere, the promised land. So maybe that's Zionism. So yes, the tribal part of the Jews is Persian, but the literate part of Jews is Zionist.
Well, that, my point there is just that, you know, being a Jewish princess, which yes, I will always claim to be that, doesn't limit me in what I explore or investigate or study theologically.
Well, you can't be your chemical body. It's only one-fifth of you. You've got to explore the TV impulse, the tip impulse, and all the other information stuff. That's why we're not limited to our national identities anymore.
But that's also why I feel like, yes, I am Jewish, but also it's not limited to that.
Well, that's the
it's
mentality,
not, but,
you know.
But it can be. If you want to call me a Jewish princess, I will take that all day long.
Right,
that's how I feel.
It doesn't mean anything. You're more interested in what you create online and what your website shows. That's where if people start criticizing that, you might be a bit more sensitive about it, because that's your chip self.
I don't even have anything on the internet.
You got your own website.
It has been viewed like maybe, I want to say 22 times, but that's
yeah,
obviously...
Yeah, by me. I'm the only guy who fucking... You got that? About me. Sarah has a whole website that wrote to me.
It's not even just about... It's notes to you. It's like, by the way, Bob... Well,
yeah,
I was muted on the last
this.
Show.
Yeah, that's great. Yes, they were great. So, you got Jeff here, you got Madeline, you got Susan. What? Aren't you guys saying anything? And Clinton?
Yeah, and Rick.
I'm Drew.
Have we had too much of Sarah? Do I mute Sarah? You can't take her anymore? She's shutting you off?
Oh, my God, Sarah.
You mind?
You're so Jewish. No, I don't care.
I wanted to comment, Bob, about your video with Roxana Synthesis.
Oh, isn't that great? The close-up of me. My face.
But isn't that... All of them are a close-up of you.
Bob is exactly the guy who would say,
was
wasn't it so great
than usual.
To see a close-up of my face?
What did you say, Clinton? What's
I
so
said,
great
you are...
Clinton praising me?
I said, Bob, you're the exactly the guy who would brag about how great a close-up of his own face was.
That's right. I celebrate myself, Clinton. You'll learn too someday.
Wait. Myself or you?
Both. You will celebrate yourself as a reaction to celebrating me.
Oh,
you,
of course.
One
you
day
mind.
You'll look back, Clinton, and you'll go, hey, fucko.
If you do what I do, Clinton, you're going to have a This is a corporate
rule. Let's
sing
the song.
I'm not talking about me personally. I'm talking about
Let's
me
sing
as
Clinton
an environment.
Song. Let's sing Clinton's song. Hey, bucko.
Okay, back to...
Why are you trying to save the world?
Well,
I can't even take
Sarah.
Care of myself. Don't ask me to join your cult. I'm still working on my books on my shelf.
Look at that.
Yep. Start yourself out, fucko.
And I don't mute her utter fascist tendencies. It's just, it's rude, you know?
So, oh, yeah.
Is that rude?
I'm sorry for being
rude. Is that
rude,
Clayton?
I know.
We want to explore my image that Susanna's brought up. We don't want to hear your singing.
No. I don't know. I guess this show isn't a democracy, so... I guess what everyone wants is important
democracy.
Is what Bob wants, right? Not what everyone else wants. Okay,
I have a
fine.
Question about Trump.
Yeah, no, just a minute. Wait a minute, Suzette. Yeah, Clinton. Roxy said we were joking on Saturday night. She says, yeah, we all just call in to compliment Bob. That's Bob's show. Anyway,
even Ion says, it's all about Bob. It's all about
Bob. Ion even says it. Hey, and I do my best at making it interesting for you. I don't quote myself. I quote all these other sources, which you end up going to used bookstores and buying and celebrating.
True, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Clinton. So he knows every book you bought and even tells you what page to
I told you what there was in each book.
That's the best card of the book. It's page 246. The quote is there. There's a quote there. That's the most amazing quote of the whole book.
Right. I stay on duty. I may be a narcissist, but I keep my role of helping you enhance your perceptions.
Absolutely. Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's opaque.
That is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But it's unique. So the great synthesis. It just seemed to me I was closer than usual to the camera, Susanna.
Oh, yeah. No, but it was fine. It was good. Is the reason is you never have the lights on, is that why it always looks dark? Or is that a graphic element that Roxana puts on?
I think Roxana doesn't like a full light on it. It's right beside me, so we move it so it's dark. Because she doesn't want to have herself in the reflection.
Oh,
and I think it causes her to be seen more holding the camera if the light is too much on my end.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And sometimes she does do visual graphic effects to make you more blurry in the background.
Yeah, she'll do different things, you know. You know, when I
but on that one, there wasn't anything.
Yeah, like maybe I got a big pimple or something there. She'll put color effects to cover it up. She's very, very good. You know, pro Bob designer. You know, she's trying to make me look acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Well, you always look good, Bob. You always look good.
Right, but what I said was pretty deep. I added some ion points about the three kingdoms and overlaid it on my chart. That was the new synthesis.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was interesting that got what triggered in my pondering as I was listening to what you were saying. And even you meant Roxy is big about the dark to the light, the journey from the dark to the light, and that you even said, well, it's bigger than that. That is even too simplistic what is going on.
Yeah, she's trying
now.
To get her out of that limited. The Android meme replays darkness to light, so it's it's squared, and it's a limited literate effect. So. I don't know if she's going to get it the way I want her to get it, but she keeps going back to that's the archetype. She keeps being seen, and it's true. It is everywhere in all cultures, but that's because people were starting to become univocal and started to get into writing, so they created a duality. They hoiked up the duality and lost the polarity, the frequency, the vibrational proximity, and the other characteristics that I talk about. They just got too much into the yin-yang.
And what you were talking about, what triggered in me was what Ion has mentioned several times about the people who are not and being Ion nots. And talking about the interval. And so I'm thinking, well, does that mean what being not is being not, how do I, hold on, let me see if I can articulate what I'm thinking. So you have human create, as being human, you're creating, you're constantly creating, but you're not your creations. And so that means that's, you are a not. So whatever it is
right.
it's creating is not the creations. And that's
okay,
what...
Okay, here's how you look
are.
At it. You take the physical, the non-physical. The physical is visible and tactile, and non-physical is not. So McLuhan used to quote these Zen poems where the emptiness of a vase was an important part of the vase. See, the Westerner thinks the emptiness is empty, is nothing there. It's a dead space. But the pre-literate cultures see emptiness as a vibrant, useful complement or half part of the substance. So a window is valuable because it has nothing. That's what you, that nothingness in the window allows you to see through it. The vase has an emptiness that you put the water in. So the nothingness is complementary, like a yin-yang, of something. So McLuhan said, you know, the Catholic believes that you can have something out of nothing. But people, Westerners, think it's an empty nothing-nothing. But it's a vibrant nothing. And that's what Ayn is constantly basically trying to tell us, that the non-physical is very much part of your life, but you block it with your visual bias and thinking that there's nothing there.
And
that's
what, the reference what, to vacuums and black holes
yes.
as well. I
yep.
mean, that Ayn has
yep.
brought that up in explaining what that is, that it's not
yeah, the the vibrancy of the void, of the nothingness,
yes.
which is not
yes.
nothing. So what did you, the darkness to the light, if you take a visual bias, you think the Westerner thinks darkness is bad, empty, rattlesnakes, you know, pain, and you go to the light, but the mature perceiver sees darkness as complementary to light. Lucifer is not evil, you know, there's no negative. It's a natural process where
right.
one thing has to be the opposite of the other, or you wouldn't notice it. So it's contrast, and contrast is a tactile interplay. It's not a painful obliteration of yourself.
And I guess what triggered did me was the fact that nothingness, or what that it, that can't, what we are not able to define because it's not in our experience, that's what creates, or that
that's
is,
right. Out of nothingness, we get something.
Right. So it made sense to me what Ayn was talking about when they said that the people who are not... What
are
was
cool.
he referencing when they were talking about the people
I
who are not?
I had forgotten that. When I name people Ayanots, we say Ayanets, then I choose Ayanots. I was thinking A-U-T...
No.
The astronaut,
yeah,
but I forgot it's Ayn not. It's N-O-T.
N-O-T, right.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
there were some recordings I was listening to, and they were talking about the people who are not. That
yes.
was the, they were talking about the 12 tribes. Maybe it was in
yeah.
Revelations. It was people who are
well,
not. That's when I first
that's
heard
the deep,
phrase.
The deep religious or sacred awareness is that you're in a world that looks like it's real, but what is not visible is just as real or more real. So all gurus
right.
try to wake you up to your sensory hypnosis and get you out of
mm-hmm.
Your box your mind put you in because
right.
of your sensory embedment. Now, LaRouche says that. LaRouche says Plato's more is better than Aristotle. Aristotle mentions the senses too much, and Ayn's and LaRouche says the senses distort. Then McLuhan updated it and said, well, we got new... electronic environments that are numbing you and encasing you like visual space or nature
mm-hmm.
did to you.
Mm-hmm.
So you got
mm-hmm.
further delusions you're lost in, and we got to find out new ways to get you to see through and come to that point where you're in the world but not of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it doesn't
and
mean
and
you go to another world, you know,
right,
you escape
right.
to heaven. But there's more than
so,
what you see.
So,
seeing is not believing.
Bob, how many people actually achieve that and then just assume that they've gone crazy because they're experiencing all these resonances and then they're just completely lost and they go creating their own crazy exegesis out of their, you know, visual... Or
okay,
their...
now here's a good point. Now, here's what McLuhan said about that. Some people are born with grace. And he talked about Melville, who wrote novels, Moby Dick and all that, and he had the European secret society metaphors in his novels. And McLuhan said that Melville, as a naive American, when he learned the European secret society stuff in the 19th century, it because he didn't have an innate grace, he was a jerk in some way, he went nuts. He couldn't take, he got all upset about these secret societies. So Hugh Kenner says about McLuhan, Hugh Kenner is a famous student and famous critic after McLuhan, he said the thing about McLuhan that was amazing is McLuhan got into the conspiracy stuff and he got through it. He didn't get lost in it, get stuck in it.
Right.
And so he complimented McLuhan for that. And I think that's what McLuhan had. He had grace. Like I have grace. I call it a sunny disposition. I can go into all these dark areas and all these bad scenes and come out shining. Now my shit doesn't even smell anymore, you know? So the thing is that having grace, which I see Carolyn has too, has also, is something, who knows where it comes from. Maybe you have a reasonable parental situation, you know? You're given comfort and all your childish needs are satisfied, so you're relatively balanced. If you're not balanced, you become a, you know, juvenile delinquent, or you become a drug dealer. You actually get into the secrets of stuff, but it distorts you.
I'm wondering if it's
so that's one way to look at it, Clinton.
That's a very good point, and that's a very good point. I'm wondering about even if you find the percepts but lack any exposure to any sort of concepts which might adhere or become affordances from which you can, you know, actually integrate successfully in some sort of strong interval between your acoustic sense and your visual sense, right? Because, I mean, if you don't have the words to fill your conscious stream of thought, which arises from the typographical side, then your percepts lack any sort of symbols on which to affix, right?
Right.
I mean,
okay, so
except through expression through art, if it's all pictures, right? If you're a movie person and it's all pictures, you got to go make films to express yourself because you lack the oral sense or the actual words.
Okay, let me respond to that. So McLuhan writes in his article on the secret societies, and he talks about Paul Claudel as the balanced Catholic poet who can go into the secret society of time and the secret society of space. He says that the children of darkness like color and imagery, and the children of light aren't into imagery. So that can be considered a biased setup, but it's interesting he says that. You got to look at it. So now you were saying something. I was going to add a point. He says, Norman Mailer, who was a friend and follower of McLuhan, he liked marijuana, and he used it as an adult, and he was an early beatnik guy. But he said he does not let his children do drugs because, say, marijuana. He says you're 16 and you do marijuana. You'll get all these insights, but you don't have enough conceptual left hemisphere Western information in your head, and which makes you articulate. Once
to correlate it.
Enlightenment. So he says his kids should not take marijuana until they become good at left hemisphere college courses and regular conceptual information. Then they can see what it all means when they take marijuana or get the right hemisphere effect.
Yes.
So that was a smart statement.
That's everybody who does mind-expanding drugs and then tries to grasp at saying, yeah, man, it's like you're one with everything. And that's as far as they can fucking articulate the experience. Like, when I was going through
because they don't have a lot of concepts.
I was typing 5,000 words a day when I was going through that shit, and I wasn't even on any drugs. But it was,
I know. Now, you have a healthy background of reading and getting concepts, so that when you get psychedelicized by different media, you have a vocabulary for it.
Yes. For fuck's sakes, and yes. And, I mean, McLuhan was a giant on whose shoulders I could stand in that regard. But, yes, when you're tripping balls,
Why you got to study Bob. You've got to go through the conceptual training. You may have, maybe 40 or 50 years old, and you're already damaged. But, we can correct that with the drops. But the, I would say, looking at you on the video, you have a sunny disposition. You seem to have a state of grace about yourself. In encountering your peer groups, so you're lucky. You know, you basically have a good sense of humor, and you were very polite with Harold Channer. He was being ignorant, and you just were polite. So the parents are telling you to be a good kid, and don't get lost into the hedonism and what your other jerks are doing, because they don't have any decent family life and they're all empty. So they start smoking, drinking, and fucking at 12 years old. they're lost by the time they're 20, because they don't have the left hemisphere built on them in there. So so the question, though, once you're an educated college kid, so anybody here who's got kids, you now have to tell your kids, okay, you learned all this stuff, you got your degree, well, it was all a waste of fucking time. Now, here's what the real stuff is.
You've
got to get them out of their discipline and their hypnosis.
Yeah,
otherwise, they just become well-adjusted jerks.
Right, you know? And in this is from long ago, long before McLuhan or whatnot, but the terminology I have for that is they have to suffer a severe narcissistic injury, which collapses their sense, and then they have to rebuild themselves into a new sort of form of resiliency out of the parts, which I guess in McLuhan terms would be Humpty Dumpty has to pull himself back together again. But you know, it's the phraseology we use in my circles is that shame is the is how you sweat out the narcissism. So when your ego is destroyed and then you gain this self-awareness where you see who you've really been all along and how everyone has been staring at you and just like playing into your own deluded self-image where they all know what you really look like, and now you know how you've looked to them all along, and you gain this sort of reflexive self-awareness. And it's shameful, right? It's horrible. You're like, oh my god, I've been a fucking fool for the last 10 years, and now I'm horribly ashamed for the sort of person I've been, that everyone's been playing up to me. No one was even straight to me. No one even fucking just told me the straight shit, like, hey, you're a fucking idiot. Like, what's wrong with you, right? Everyone plays along with you, and you go, oh my god, they've been looking at me being a fool for fucking 10 years now, and no one said shit, right? And you're ashamed, right? So shame is how you sweat out the narcissism.
Okay, hold it, Clinton.
Yeah.
That's the perversity of youth. Everybody is working out their identity and how they are in relation to their peers.
Yes.
At the same time, they like you making mistakes because you're entertaining to them. They say, oh, look, it could be fucked up. Well, I'm not that bad, so maybe I'm okay. But that person who says that doesn't know that they're a dupe for something that other people see in him.
That's right. But the internet in the past decade, well, no, actually for the past 3 decades, but that's a very small sample until, it grew. The internet has allowed people like this to find a support group, to find thousands of people like them, and to double down on their egos, and they go decades supporting their fucking selves in a whole support group, a whole identity group of, activists championing their own. They stretch. It's a tetrad reversal. It's like, hey, that phase you were supposed to go through, everything's speeding up because of electronic conditions. But boom, now because of the scope of the internet, you can belager and prolong and protract your one immature phase that you're supposed to get through 6 months of awkward adolescence. You can turn that into 20 years of life.
Right. That's the disservice, and they never grow up, and they can't be mature millennials.
Yeah, because there's 20,000 of them on the planet, and half of them are part of the same fucking web forum, and they all just fucking, build each other up in this,
So that was McLuhan's mediacology. He says, yes, books are not constitutive, but they're important to develop a person's eyeball. So if you're a comprehensive growing late teen, early 20s, you develop yourself in all media. You don't say books are obsolete, I'm never going to read again, and just become an interneting, texting idiot.
Uh-huh.
That's the beehive. Yeah, you know how to work in the beehive, and as McLuhan says in Mediumism and Massage, Joyce knew how to work in every cultural modality. That's true maturity. That's what you all got to develop, your ability to work with LaRouche, who's very different from McLuhan, and then work with McLuhan, or Thompson's very different, and Coker and Dobbs, and then the drops, and then Ion. You've got to be comprehensive.
That's the formula for well-roundedness. You find there's a sort of orthogonality or independent axes along each of those people who splay open the mind to a sufficient capacity to interpolate their sensory events thereafter.
Right, and this is confused by the extension of the different bodies. You got to learn body knowledge and the new bodies, and so media diet has to be balanced. That's why McClellan said, "Let me run the United Nations, and I'll have a computer. And when Venezuela is too embedded in the newspaper, we'll give them some radio. Or Canada needs some TV." And so that was a metaphor, collective. So a collective clairvoyance, a collective balance, a collective yoga was what had to be done. We all had to become aware that we should be able to replace McLuhan if he dropped off and redo McLuhan as the Tetra manager of the global environment, which was the famous line from the 19th century of ontogeny
recapitulates phylogeny. Yeah.
Right. So the development of the individual psychology is the same process the species goes through. So McLuhan said we need to discover our species extensions, the new nature we're in, and it will mime the drama of cognition or the stage of apprehension he talks about in the early 50s that the art object does, the Gutenberg private identity. And so what was I going to say about that? So the yogi or the maturing person knows how to develop their senses and integrate them and use them all. We then have to do the extended parallels to our senses and learn how to use all media diets. Now, while we're doing that in the 1670s, there were separate media, but now it's merged into this weird black hole. And so it's very hard for people to recover a sense of individual sensory biases or their media extensions when they have immediately merged and the seatbelt's off the day they're born.
All right, I'll tell you. Jordan Peterson, he has been touring with Dave Rubin, who is a YouTube celebrity. And Dave Rubin has a very big show. He was a left-winger who became a libertarian after getting, you know, like, woke or whatever. Anyway, Dave Rubin has taken a month off of YouTube, and he's put his phone in a safe, and he's doing a one-month media fast as a demonstrative act, hoping other people will emulate him. For all of August, he's saying, "I'm the guy who goes around with Jordan Peterson, and for 1 month, I'm not connecting to the internet whatsoever, and other people should do this every once in a while," and he's trying to start this thing.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's not Joe Rogan.
No.
Dave Rubin?
Yes. Who's...
All right, and they have a dialogue on the show, on their tour?
Yes, the book tour. Peterson goes around talking about his book to, like, 20,000, well, no, 2,000 people, right? And, like, he tours the country, and Dave Rubin is, like, his warm-up act, his right-hand man, his young, trendy, And Dave...
And Rubin became a fan of Peterson.
Yes, and Rubin's had his own, basically, it's a long-form interview show. It's basically conversations with Channer, but it's Rubin, and it's been on YouTube for about 4 or 5 years now, before Peterson ever came to the fore. Yeah, and so...
Right. See, and you've heard me explain how this is the flip of the 60s, that the individualist natural bias of the West in the 60s was confronting the beehive effect that the global theater of TV, computers, and satellites was bringing in. So there was a huge identity crisis. So McLuhan was the Virgil, like Virgil for Dante, was the guide about how to adjust a bit of yourself to the new collectivity, to the new acoustic tactility. Okay? So people were trying to, you'll see it in the popular psychologies, they were trying to sort of play down their literate ego and develop a sense of groupiness. And there was all kinds of different forms of this in popularity. It's just like the Leonard Bernstein, you know, major classical music conductor, sort of had to say, maybe this Beatle music isn't just kids' music. So they had to adjust to the and put on the electronic beehive music. Now, Zappa was a perfect balanced guy for all that, so he was the model. Anyways, now you have the Matrix, then becomes super angelization of everybody with their Web 2.0 thrones, where they make their own media. So... now we've become hived over the last, say, 25, 30 years. Now the challenge is to retrieve your visual left hemisphere conceptual self, with a little bit of private identity and separate from the political correctness tribal mandates.
Yeah.
And that's what Jordan is. So he comes out of the University of Toronto with the opposite agenda of McLuhan.
Yes.
Of rebuilding conceptual ability.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
And it's resonate, you know, he's helping people become what the media is leading them towards. So if you want to criticize McLuhan, he looked like he was too pro-tribal. But
yeah.
He wasn't, if you got to know him.
He was, right. He was.
Peterson can,
saying it was coming. He was announcing its arrival, but it wasn't.
Yes.
He was neutral.
Neutral. He thought it was a good balancing to the dip surfaces of literate bias and individual bias. So Jordan's coming along, and he's looks like he's too conceptual, too left hemisphere. And so the left hemisphere Marxist critics say he gets his facts all wrong. But they don't understand that he doesn't have to have facts, he's just presenting the style of visual space through visual space ideas from Plato to Carl Jung and everybody else. He's encyclopedic.
Yes.
So
people complain that too many
complain that he's pushing, you know, the tribal women, the Me Too people, the tribal feminists will say this guy's right winger. He's too individualistic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he appears like McLuhan to be a little too extreme. That doesn't mean he is extreme, but his image come across that way because other media translate him that way. So he has to bring in McLuhan media awareness to balance off his left hemisphere apparent bias, and Dave Rubin is doing it by saying, I'm taking a media fast. You know, that's important.
Yeah. Yes.
That balances off Jonathan's image.
Oh. I don't know Jonathan's image.
Peterson's image.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's Jordan. Yeah, he bounces off Peterson's image.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yes, he does. Yeah.
And, you know, we noticed the last couple of months people were writing me saying, look, Peterson mentioned Billy McLuhan, you know. And McLuhan started to come up in his
He's talking a lot more in a technologically deterministic sense lately.
Yes.
Probably
because he naturally began to see it. His whole success has put him into the beehive, and he's starting to notice things. He's a normally intelligent guy. He said, wait a minute, there's a whole other thing going on here that is not, it's contradicting my message, which is to put out a bunch of content that you match with intellectually, and you prop up your literate self, your independent discipline. But he's seeing, man, I got 2 million people looking at my YouTubes. They're not getting the content the way I do it. I'm appealing to people on another level of image. And that's why he said in a recent interview, did you see that one where they asked him, where's this all going? He says, it's going to tragedy.
I'm riding a wave.
His own career.
Yeah, yeah. He's riding a wave, but usually, you know, when you're that high up, you.
Yes.
It's the metaphor, yeah.
See, he's not aware of his quadrophenia. Now, the balanced person about all this, who should be having trillions of people following, is me, of course, right?
Of course.
I'm way
yes.
better than Peterson, but that's never the way it is. I'm the Frank, just like Zappa was to McLuhan, I am to Peterson. And I throw Carol in it. Me and Carol, we're a duo. We got all these individuals, McLuhan by himself, Peterson by himself. But I did notice yesterday they're having articles on he and his wife's relationship.
Oh. The more the media, the media is digging their own grave, doing half-assed jobs.
They're digging everybody's grave. They got to run through the whole stages of apprehension, like shown on my chart. They all are suicidal.
Yeah.
And but then there's always new media, and it just keeps going. And then there's also always newcomers coming in who just arrived in 1965, you know? So they redo it for us. The immigrants do that.
Yeah. Right. Right. Fair enough. That's true. Fresh eyes. Uncontaminated.
Yeah, they come in, they believe in the American dream, they prop up the hologram, they want their kids to do well in school, they want to go get them to university, they don't care about the expense, and they don't know the disaster that's waiting for them at university, where everybody has a fucking identity crisis and ends up in some tribe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh my God.
You avoid it by not doing university. You didn't go to university, really, right?
Yeah, I dropped out after a year and a half, and I basically stayed in my room on the computer the whole time as opposed to actually partaking in any of the shit. Yeah.
Flaked yeah, now it. You're balancing it by staying in the room and reading.
Yeah. Yeah. Whoa.
Okay, so the rest of you, what do you have to say to this? We're putting out a good wisdom there, Jeff. Does Jeff want to ask something? Let's see if Jeff's still there. Oh, he didn't wait around. You gotta wait around. We'll get to you. We're not ignoring you. Susanna, you wanna say something?
Well, it sounds like balance. Balance is important in all things.
Well, that's what Ian said. But it's not, Susanna, it's not a visual balance. It's not based on your eye.
That's what I'm saying. I didn't say that.
Good. Yeah, if you get that, it's a
balance of, yeah, it's a balance on many different levels, on many different things. I mean,
you see, visual balance,
mineral.
Hey, Susanna, let me supplement
vegetable.
What you're trying to say. Visual balance.
I'm sorry.
Resist acoustic chaos. Comprehensive tactile balance can enjoy chaos, can swim in it, and then retrieve their private visual aspect. See, that's the new balance, not generally, the stiff-lift conservative, neoconservative, wants to get back to visual balance. And those that see that's ineffective plunge into the non-visual effort and lose their balance. They don't know how to balance in non-visual environments.
Bob, is this a non-physical recapitulation of the fish who did not discover water evolving into the frog who does?
Yes, or, you know, the caterpillar. Says to the butterfly, you'll never get me up in one of those contraptions.
Right. So if you can suspend and ameliorate and dissolve your literary balance for a time while dealing with the chaos and then reform, that's a very amphibious form of...
Yep.
That's the frog versus the fish who never saw the water to begin with.
Yeah, you have to realize the disservice of literate balance. You have to see, this is where Mark Stallman says that McLuhan is trying to retrieve Catholic Thomism. No, that does not. The new kind of Thomism, which McLuhan was trying to educate people on, was not a conceptual anchor and retrieving some kind of concept of sensory balance. You had to go into the chaos. And I would say, for any problem any of you people have out there, let go. Now, which the New Agers would often say.
See,
but you wouldn't think McClure would say that. And therefore, his studying of pagan, Gnostic artists and hedonists was necessary. He said, you don't get salvation from these artists, but they know your sensory life. You get sensory training going into these multi-sensuous art forms.
Right.
That was necessary, and that's what Mark Stallman doesn't get. He thinks that McLuhan's anti-Gnostic. And I even asked McLuhan through the Evergreens, I said, why were you anti-Gnostic? And he said, well, first of all, let me say, it's not completely wrong or bad, Gnosticism. There's some usefulness of it. See, so he had a balanced view about it.
Uh-huh.
Yes, he was operating from a no-zone position, which is tactility because it's not a sense.
He's
in the balancing apparatus of tactility.
I just read the letter where he described how the Greco-Roman... preserved the Greco-Roman preserved the typographical sense due to the not typographical but rather you know there was no type but you know the written sense and you got the Jewish people who what was it
you just were reading it in the letters just now or
yeah
a
like
few
a few hours ago a few hours ago it was like 1972
well he's talking about the services of the Greco-Roman.
Yes, and then he's comparing it in some paradoxical way to what Jewish people did, which was to be even more typographical, I think. Hold on.
Yeah. No, so, see, the letters book is very important because he explains a lot of himself that he doesn't do in his books, which have another motive. And everything is like reading, it's like having him as your classroom teacher and you're in his classes reading those letters. So you're going to learn a lot from them. He fills in a lot. He didn't hold back. But again, that is, you don't want to get hypnotized by the letter as a medium. That's the bias of letters. Someone asked him, why do your letters to the editors are so easy to understand? He says, well, that's because letters are an expository medium.
Okay,
they
here...
explain things.
Yes, here it is. Visual man can't tolerate the subliminal and the non-visual of his own life. Panic and inhibition characterize Greco-Roman man when his visual assumptions are either studied or threatened. Something-something Einstein... What you say about the complimenting of the Greco-Roman by the Hebraic is true enough, but when the Hebraic self-righteousness is added to the visual abstraction and specialism, you have the Western technocrat of yesteryear. Of course, ecology is acoustic and biased, and so the Hebrew is in his culture. That's one reason why the Hebrews have been so prominent in the arts of the past century. They could never be happy in an abstract visual culture, since their kind of literacy is not visual at all. So I suppose what he's saying is that Jews are so rich in their culture that they have an acoustic resonance within the richness of the profundity of the cumulative culture which comprises the written post-oral culture, or the Torah post-Jesus, I guess. It was all written, but so fucking rich they have an acoustic understanding within their literacy value, their literate values.
Yes.
Wow.
Now, what page is that? What's
two,
the date?
That's 1973. This is a letter to Barbara Ward, who was an editor of The Economist magazine on February 9th, 1973.
Yeah, she was famous, Barbara Ward. There's one Jewish guy, Sidney somebody. He says, in all your writings, I've never seen you comment on Israel. So this was a Jewish guy wanting to know if McLuhan was anti-Semitic or whatever. And you never commented on it. And for the first time, McLuhan says, he always had an answer, but this time he said, well, it's very complex, the situation of Israel. I actually don't know what to say about it. What do you think? He throws it back to him. That was very unusual that McLuhan did that. But in other writings, like you just read, he explained the Jewish culture. But for some reason, he didn't want to tell that Jewish guy that he had some answers. He wanted to bring up another angle, which is pretty, maybe he suspected a hostile, because if a person says, I've read your stuff, but I've never seen you speak about Israel, they haven't read his stuff, because he does speak about Israel. It's on the first page of Understanding Media. He talks about Jewish literature always presents a solution right in the first moment. And so that would be acoustic, immediate insight, immediate pattern, whereas the literate person starts to go through a series of arguments and logical thinking to get to an insight. They take the long road, especially after the printing press. So the Jewish having a strong, pre-printing press reality, they were not averse to instant insight, instant pattern recognition. So
right.
They would offer it on the first page.
Yeah. Right.
Anyways, what you read is really good. See, people, you got to learn how to understand these modalities in the public social mortar. You got to see the laws of this situation. It is the new science for, public conversation.
Well, hell, if people could talk about Israel with the ease and calm we just did, there would be peace on earth now, wouldn't there, Bob?
That's right. Yeah, McLuhan provides a way for people to talk and not get into heated categorical biases of the old tribalism or literate narcissism. That's why I always stood out. People say, well, Bob, he says all this stuff, but I don't know what he actually believes. He doesn't seem to have a point of view. Yeah, I'm not having any point of view.
Well, right. You're far too mediated. Your non-physical outweighs wherever the fuck you're at, and because you're flickering in the fucking interval, right?
You're too balanced.
That's right, very balanced. Ian used to even say that, Bob. You're too healthy. You're too pure in your diet. You go in an airplane, eat something, and you get fucking sick because you're too balanced. You're not used to the dirt. Now, that didn't usually happen, but. If something did bother me by what I ate, he would say that's the reason. See, so you can't be too pure. No, you don't want to be too pure.
But But there's a pee under my 18. No, man, I got 18 mattresses and I still feel pee at the bottom of them, Bob. I don't know what to do. Maybe I'm too Jewish.
Right. Well, what did you grow up as, if anything? A Catholic or what?
Catholic, yeah, yeah. I went to Catholic elementary school, Catholic high school. I'm not baptized, but it was the right choice in my situation.
You went? Did you go to confession?
Never. No, I never took communion. I never ate the Eucharist. I never went to confession. I did none of the ritualistic Catholic things. But I went to Catholic school.
Oh, you're at a Catholic school. That's the only reason.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's good. You don't want to be a Catholic. That's Susanna's problem. Brought up as a Catholic, that's a serious handicap today. And a Protestant, too. But, you know,
that's
the Protestant...
That's not balanced.
That's right. And the Protestant, because they're not oral Catholics, they're literate, they want new ideas. A turnover of identity change is the means in the Protestant. So you'll see a lot of Protestants go into the New Age. Because they under the new impact of endless change, they feel they had a change. Whereas McLuhan said in the 50s, the Catholic, being partly oral, has a little more immunity to the new oral effect of television, and so it doesn't get swept away. But in the long run, once you get into the Android meme and the digital, it upset every culture, regardless of their holism.
Indubitably.
What?
Indubitably.
Right, and so that's why we're at this point where no culture has the answers.
That's why the world needs artists.
But that's where you're saying that if you are able to be aware of your five bodies, even in the merged state, you can travel in any environment as like a gyroscope and be balanced and not be affected by the environment.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah, you actually, and to be... to do that, you can't identify with any culture. And McLuhan said in the 60s that modern man is at a high state of awareness because there's so many conflicting technologies which have conflicting technological or cultural assumptions that they are forced by default to be detached. So it's the first time you have human beings not really culturated by old cultures and old media, but they are enculturated by this endless perpetual tactile change. That's what is the challenge to everybody.
So,
but we are all at a very high level of awareness.
All right, and
by default.
And the most recent, not irritant. Okay, so listen, how long have digital cameras existed? How long has the instant feedback of a instant replay been technologically available? 15 years tops. And then you got smartphones with their like front-facing selfie cams, right? Cell phones are the new mirror, the new narcissistic mirror, offering a quick closure on a reflection of a sort which can be transmitted and mediated across time. And so people identify with their mediated narcissistic self-observation through the cell phone across social media nowadays.
It's an instant culture, an instant pattern, which lasts, you know, 6 hours. So that's, it has to be fast and it has to be droppable because you're going to make a new pattern right after that.
Yes,
a new culture.
And it's the right time frame to attune to a high frequency of tickling the dangling ganglia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And the stress of all that, most people can't take this forever. That's where our products come in. It actually, you know, alleviates the stress of trying to keep up with the present, what the Evereese defined as the second coming, a time of perpetual change. Nobody's ever been in a culture, unless pre-caveman weirdness was going on, but McLuhan said way back then was a private, isolated individual before they were tribalized in acoustic speech. But today, we've got all those dynamics included, and the endless stress. So every day people get up as a new person and they engage some part of the digital environment, their chip body, to see what their culture is today.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Take today. Yeah.
Take today.
And so everybody, and that's why people have to keep looking. They've got to see what is the culture for the next 6 hours. And it's some meme, some theme, some something that happened. or a various bunch of stuff that happened, depending how wide-ranging you can take it in. But it is an inhuman and ridiculous process of endless surfing that, in the end, wipes everybody out, and they get exhausted and just become suicidal.
Burnout, total burnout. Hence,
burnout all the time.
Hence the
the
media fast. I mean, if you can stand ignoring the spectacle for a month, if you can get through not being part of the zeitgeist at that precise for a month, if you can get through that, you're gonna pull yourself.
That's the new yoga.
Yeah.
That is the new yoga. Not the Maharishi yoga, not the chemical body or astral body yoga.
The question
is dealing with this endless pressure.
If you leave the world, will it still be there when you come back? Will you miss the finale?
Yeah, so you've got to go through a kind of death. That's a media fast.
Yeah.
It's like in the Eskimos, when you were an old person, you would eventually just leave the tribe one night in the middle of a party and go off and die. That was their way of leaving. They were pretty mature about it. I don't think they believed that it was the end. So the old lady would go off and freeze to death, and that was nice. They didn't cause any problems. You've got to do that while staying in the physical by having a media fast often.
I'm sure it's very George Costanza style. Just leave when you're ahead.
Yeah, who's that? I've heard that name, George Costanza. What's that?
he's a character.
Oh yeah, like George on Seinfeld, right? I never saw Seinfeld much. Watched it, but
one episode he learned that after he tells a funny joke, he should just go, "That's it," and leave on a high, as opposed to ruining it, because he used to always like tell a funny joke and then try a bunch more and ruin it.
Right. He was the chubby guy with the glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah, the loser guy. Yeah, he always blew it.
Yeah, he was Larry
and
David.
So, see, when I said, George Costanza, I heard of him. In this context, Susanna laughed because I sounded like I'm citing an author. And then you guys know he's a TV character.
Yeah.
And so your old-fashioned literary bias is, look at Bob. He thinks it's an idea. But no, it's we're so flooded by characters, it is as valuable as Nietzsche.
Hey, Bob, have you ever heard of Kenneth Gergen?
You've talked about him, and I read a summary of his book years ago. I think he was at the first Mediacology conference in 98.
Wow. Yeah. His book is fantastic. It's the most succinct. Well, it's called The Saturated, right? It's all about postmodernism, and it's completely content-centric. But he just assumes everyone's going to get a totally well-rounded Penelope, a well-rounded, set of archetypes who will let them be anyone in any situation, like they're some kind of, like, perfect actor, right? And that's not how the selection of media consumption works. People end up, just doubling down on their stereotypes, right? But it's like, hey, as long as everyone lets go of any sort of principles and any sort of central storage to life and any narrative to their identity, then everyone can just perfectly adapt to the scene in the now and change and be six different people all at once, the end, right? The saturated self, right? Because we're all so full of every different argument that we're all people all at once, and all the archetypes perfectly balance themselves out in some sort of super psychology, right?
Well, he never mentioned Finney's Wake. He doesn't have the perception to know that Finney's Wake already laid that out for us and shows us that.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
lifestyle, but the so you're saying that he's trying to teach you how to surf the information overload.
Yeah, and that's to erase any sort of narrative continuity in your life, and just always be who you need to be in the particular setting that you're in. So you show up to like the BDSM group and you're a total kinkster, and then you show up to the church group and you're a pious saint, and then you show up to the biker gang and you fucking smash the guy overhead with a bottle.
That's my quadrophenia.
Right. Wherever you are what the archetype pulled out of you as saturated by the overabundant information economy, right?
Right. So when Rushkoff says be program or be programmed, it's not an either-or choice. There are situations where you will be programmed And what you just said is advisable. You know, put on where you're at.
Yeah, put on, yes, precisely.
He doesn't, he's getting you used to doing that, but he doesn't know how to express the detached, non-involved person.
Right.
When you are not being programmed, which you can, that's available to you too. So
that would be transcendence.
You have to have a comprehensive quadriphenia.
Yeah, see, that would be transcendent, and that flies in the face of the postmodern insofar as
right.
It's applied by...
They're correct. See, they're correct to say there's no truth and we're all swallowed up in the programmed environment. That's what McLuhan was saying. But they didn't have a way of being detached. They were just warning you, you will be sucked into this by default, and most of you won't understand it, and you'll just disappear. They didn't have a good a way to get out of it or to take a break from it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you brought in LaRouche, that'd be a good break, or you retrieve parts of McLuhan or Thompson or Croker, that's the way you do it. And so that's what I was an expert at, the solution.
Mm-hmm.
I know exactly what Gergen's saying, and he's correct, but it's only half the story.
Right, right.
See, most books are only half the story because by the nature of writing, you have to have a point of view, unless you're going to do Finney's Wake. And this point of view will mean you'll emphasize one side or the other.
It will illuminate a figure, and then the ground will be left for to be in, you know, filled in through subtext by the reader, which is the whole death
right.
of the author thing.
And so the liberal is unpopular because the liberal actually does try to be uninvolved and balanced, but doesn't know why that position is useful and can't translate into media dynamics. So they end up looking like an old fuddy-duddy wimp who goes along with anything and wants everybody to get along.
Oh, yeah, they don't know the ground.
They don't know the fragmentation. You got cultures now are all hoiking themselves up. They're all becoming they got Trump leaders, and they're trying to retrieve a national identity because the global merger is just so shocking.
Yeah.
They've had it for 30 years, so... So they're temporarily trying to create the anti-environment of a local identity, and that's not going to work, but it makes the liberal image of the globalists really anemic. See, the liberals don't know how they should infiltrate the Republican Party. They say, yeah, Trump's right, and go in there and try to massage Trump's, you know, retroactive, whatever he's trying to do is retrieve tribalism of America, which is a kinetic visual bias. They just feel threatened by it, and they are. They should be threatened because they are obsolete. Their method of public put-on doesn't work because people are too riled up, and there's too many, you know, kings and Indian chiefs in the kitchen now. Everybody's an Indian chief.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go in there and say, let's all get along, you know, like Marianne Williamson says. You got to come in there like me saying, I'm fucking in charge. I started this whole fucking thing, and I'm worth listening to. So calm down and get smart.
Uh-huh.
Shut
uh-huh.
up, Bob explained. See?
Mm-hmm.
And Clinton still has a bit of old liberal tolerance in him, so he says, Bob, you're sounding megalomaniac. You sound like a Nazi. What's going on here? Well, you got to be able to prop that up there, Clinton, every now and then. And you better have your fucking resources ready, because if you start going in bragging, they're going to say, okay, big boy, let's see how big your dick is. Then you're going to have to show it.
Lyndon
so
Johnson.
You got to be ready for that.
Yeah.
What?
Lyndon Johnson.
Isn't
so
that why
happened?
I am supposed to stay stealth? So not
yes. Silence, exile, cunning, Joy said. Now, here's the thing.
Yes.
I was totally vulnerable in 2009. But then my big stick showed up, Ion, and I had a ventriloquist dummy. I just said, oh, you got a problem? Okay. And then they said, I have to talk to Ion. That was my cover. That was my shield.
Right.
Yeah, but even in even in my discussions with Ion, when I've spoken with them, they have said, don't talk too much about all this stuff.
Right. They tell you to be careful. It's too powerful.
Men in the white coats will come and knock on your door.
That's an Alan Parsons song from iRobot. which is covered by Pat Benatar on her debut album. It's called...
Way back there? Way back in 81?
Yes, yes. Pat Benatar covered an Alan Parsons Project song called Don't Let It Show. And it's one of these songs which is exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Alan Parsons is... What I like about him is in 74, they did... You ever see the movie Oh, Lucky Man?
Oh, that Alan Parsons engineered that?
Well, he did the soundtrack, which is basically it's a really good song. It says you're a lucky man if you have found someone in whom you can trust.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that.
And, you know, the story is about Malcolm McDowell, you know, getting into endless problems because he ended up not trusting anybody. Everybody was doing him in.
Yeah. I should watch that again.
So anyways, I don't know the Pat Benatar song. Not offhand.
You never listened to iRobot? It's a great album.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, Alan Parsons, iRobot.
I consume albums.
Right.
I only caught up with music thanks to YouTube and having to have music for the show. That's when I redid everything, discovered everything.
Oh, better... You see, you wait for the cream to rise to the top. See, again... Everyone uses Netflix nowadays, and I was when I was free roaming the oceans of the fucking World Wide Web before fucking everyone. When I was in the foam, we had the entire videography of all of Western fucking movies, not a mere couple thousand movies to pick from off a curated playlist. So I was watching right like you can go talk to anyone and. You still can. People still do it, but it's not constitutive of what it means to watch movies on the computer anymore. Before Netflix, watching movies on the computer meant you had the entire library of every movie ever fucking made at your fingertips, because it was so hard to do, you might as well, you know, like, explore everything. Now, right? So, yeah, I saw Oh Lucky Man, I saw Videodrome, I saw Network, I saw... you know, like, just all the movies.
All the greats
that everyone was talking about. And, yeah. And now it's so easy to watch 80% of the best movies that ever maxed out a fucking box office, fucking gross, whatever the fuck. That's all people stick to nowadays because it's too easy. People don't pirate.
Well, you're saying they don't get the greats, or what do they get?
They don't.
It's too easy.
Well, they get the things that are on Netflix, which includes, you know... alien conspiracy documentaries that are probably financed by the Scientologists, and, you know...
Oh, they get lost. They don't get the quality stuff.
Yeah, they get something curated by a corporation, which is, yeah, exactly, a publicly owned corporation, not the full entire fucking unrestricted canon of everything, because it's hard to do in the first place, and thus you're stealing...
I noticed that on Netflix. I go there, and if I do scan, there's nothing there.
There's nothing there.
I wait to Ed Long to tell me.
Exactly. Yeah, there's nothing.
You're not going to see fucking Shock Treatment.
And the greats I've seen, so it's hard to find a new great on Netflix.
Right, right. You'll see what...
Well, they don't put the greats on there.
No, they have whatever...
Yeah, they're powerful enough not to be used, right? They don't get hijacked.
Yeah, the internet is a gilded cage now for everyone who's on it and thinks that they're in a really big fish tank, man. Like, fuck you. When it was hard, it was infinite.
Well, how did you find them? How did you find them? How did you find them?
Talking to thousands of individuals who've grown up, who were all way older than me, who had seen these movies when they came out in theaters and took the effort to take the VHS tape and turn it into a file and stick it on the internet somewhere to be laboriously downloaded over fucking, 3 days on your slow-ass connection. It was hard to begin with.
Yeah.
But there was no corporation.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many people that don't even have a clue about these movies anymore to even know they exist.
Yeah. The past is an ever-shrinking, more curated, more distilled, purified, Orwellian...
That's why my radio music is great. Someone said last week, Bob, you favor 60s and 70s music. No, I got it all decades.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's what I do. I save a lot of people here. I never heard half of those songs. They never heard them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. I know about a third, a quarter. I go, oh, yeah, I know that song. Yeah.
Well, I keep trying to find, you know, stuff that people don't know that's still good. But anyways, back to this point. What were we saying about being balanced? And we got into this, what was it just before Netflix?
No, you go a while
back.
We're
talking about being balanced, and then we got into something else.
There was the fish out of water thing, being a frog.
Oh, yeah, I was just talking about how you got to do it all and not be stuck in any one of them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Oh, a super detachment.
Oh, yes.
And it's really what Ion is defining ascension as. Ion, his words, his reference points do include the complexity of the five bodies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he is the most up-to-date, quote, guru about our situation. No other teachers are as complex as Ion and inclusive and uses my stuff. See, Gergen doesn't use the five bodies.
Oh,
he's
no.
He was good 20 years ago, but not today.
Right, right. And
now, it's good for you. You're just replaying the stages of conceptual evolution, you know. You got to go through all the classics
and
get the effects from it.
Right.
And get bored with it and then look for something else.
Yeah, that's very LaRouche needing to go through the stages, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they all talk about stages. Thompson, Croker, McLuhan, Croker, and Dobbs. You'll see it in my chart, the stages of apprehension. And there's the collective phylogeny stages, and then there's the ontogenal individual stages. So it's once you get really well-versed in this, you really have a good intellectual vision. You actually have a poetic vision of the history of technology.
Well, the greatest value is the ability to do it at the rate of oral speech in an extemporaneous sense, precluding wit d'escalier, you know, like, you're not anyone if you're too late in the conversation in the moment. And so I find the biggest problem with multiple bodies is that they're temporarily out of sync. You think too fast or
yours
think too slow.
Or
my
people?
Own. I guess I'm extrapolating. It's personal. Yes, my own. I type 110 words per minute. So it took a lot to move that fluency into a different body, you know?
Yeah.
And know how to speak it emotionally in a way that isn't, you know, awkward, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the problem with Channer. He's sort of a polymath, but he's still older and stuck in the literate point of view. So he ends up repeating himself every show. Because he doesn't know how to drop it. He doesn't know how to be wrong. See, you got to be wrong. You got to be able to put on the wrong point of view. Like me, as you say, becoming, you know, negative or megalomania. You got to be able to put that on.
Yeah, yeah, you got to work through the, yeah, yes, exactly, absolutely. That's what earnestness means, if you anticipate, see, that's ESP getting in your way. ESP says, don't do that. You're wrong, but then you need the earnestness to go be wrong, even though your ESP is saying it's going to be, so you can actually experience the consequences of it so as to have the appropriate reaction.
Right. And it allows other people, if you go wrong, then it gets them to participate.
Yeah.
They see an opening.
Yeah.
You know, McLuhan in Cliché Archetype, he defined paradox as a boxer looking for an opening.
And this is how you injure, this is how you undo the closure of narcissism coming with the ESP. If you break the...
That's around you all the time. I got to deal with you narcissists every show.
Yeah.
Right? You tend to fall back into...
If you could just break the closure of knowing you're wrong and being quiet and being wrong out loud, then you would connect with the other person. Your closure would be
then
open.
You're not afraid of language.
Yes.
Then you're not afraid of other people's opinions of you.
Right. The calluses will build. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and Ion recommends that.
No. Oh.
Go
be a fool.
So I was just going
to... You know?
Right, so we were... I was going to say something right there. So we're saying to put on the wrong, that allows involvement. And that's a callous. You don't worry what people think about you. And that's why I in the end say, you guys have no clue what I'm like unless you meet me privately, and then I'm in a chemical body, and then I'm slower, I'm not performing, and I'm reacting to you. And it's a whole different person.
I know, Bob, so, I'm Bill Cosby ghost dad. I could reach through this fucking speaker right now and punch you in the face, you wouldn't know.
What did you say about Bill Cosby?
Ghost dad.
What's that? A TV show he did?
Bill Cosby was in a really shitty 80s comedy where he died, but then he could, like, go through the telephone and punch people through the phone receiver.
That's McLuhan discarnate.
That's, yeah.
Literalizing McLuhan's insight.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you said you could do that.
Yeah, yeah. Look out. You better ready your left hook. Yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of people, they get on the media, and they're shy because they think everybody's going to remember that they fucked up, you know. They don't understand you are nothing, and you're just paid attention to when you're speaking, and then the next person comes in, and that person's listened to, you're forgotten.
Yeah.
People don't realize how they're quantumly forgotten rapidly over a 30-minute period in media interaction.
Because they're closed about their own image. It's narcissism.
That's right. They have a literate image of sort of lasting a long time.
Yeah.
We're sure. A society of quantum fluctuations. Are you following this, Susanna?
I am, and I'm noticing a lot of time in the comments.
A lot of time?
Yes. That's the limitation, the time.
Oh,
the
yeah,
time
yeah.
Time element.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And the, so I was just explaining how there's many people
who
used to hear me in media, and they really didn't like me, but they were fascinated by what an idiot I was. And then they'd meet me in person, and they'd say, well, you're a whole different person. You're actually a nice person. And I didn't get complimented by that. I just knew that they were meeting me in another medium.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Well, it's just like Roxanna.
She had
was
that
scared.
Effect.
She was scared to meet you.
So
she was nervous for a couple of days that she was going to meet what she thought was a Clint Eastwood, all-American tough guy kind of person, which she wasn't gravitating interested in, and then was shocked the way I was.
So someone
I was
who
a softy.
So it. Is someone who is consistent across media, could they just be stubborn? Because Jordan Peterson is consistent across media. I've read multiple interviews.
He's got a problem there.
Yeah.
He's got a problem.
Yeah. He's the same in person that he is on the fucking YouTube, that he is on the fucking stage. And people comment,
and that
yep.
That could be another part of his temporary charisma. Because he's the same. They're so sick of people changing in front of him all the time.
Yeah,
that his literate continuity is charismatic right now.
It's consistent across content regardless of the media, which reflects either a blindness
right.
or a stubbornness on his part.
It's platonic. He's in a transcendent position, which is vulnerable, just as an Aristotelian shapeshifter is vulnerable. But you got to be both, and a few other things that aren't Western categories.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if I ever get a chance to interact with Jordan, and if he could shut up, I'd be a psychiatrist and explain the services and disservices of his image, of what he's done, which other people, depending on their maturity, would be amazed by or outraged by. They just think I'm a guy being a know-it-all to the situation.
Yes, yes, and I mean...
You know what?
Hmm?
I was going to say, that's really interesting what you just said, Bob, about that, and what you guys have said, that Jordan Peterson is the same across media, and that's
yeah.
what's making his life successful now. But there's so many people that have that expectation that one should be the same across whatever environment you are.
Yeah.
And if you're yeah. not, that means you're fake or
yep.
you're not real.
That's the literate bias. That's the
on.
Americans' need for
it's
virtue.
Not
they call it virtue.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, it's taken as a very negative. And you're saying that you need to be that way in order to be balanced.
Yeah, you have to be able to do that, act that. We're all actors now. You have to be able to put on that mask at the appropriate time, either to serve as a teaching and environment, or just to do it for ganglia-stimulating fun.
Well,
uh-huh.
For some reason,
both.
For some reason, when I'm on, let's say when I'm on Harold Channer, I'm extremely careful in my speech, and then I come on this show and I shoot the shit like nothing I say matters. And that's merely the difference of video in one regard, and it's also, of course, the character of you versus the character of Harold. But, I mean, it's two very different media, right? And I'm two different people across it. I'll swear on your show. I'm not going to swear on fucking conversations with Harold Channer.
You're very proper on Harold's show.
Of course, right? And that's a matter of his character, right? But also a matter of you know, when I'm on your show, I appreciate that this particular format requires a sort of, you know, blindness.
And we aren't distracted by looking at you.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas in the video on Skype, we had to look at you, and you had to react to knowing that we're looking at you.
Oh, yeah, you haven't seen me eat any of the boogers that I put in my mouth all night. That's true.
Oh, jeez. That's a very effective probe there.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Like, yeah, different circumstances call pull out of oneself. Pull out of one's saturated self, as Gergen thinks. Right, pull out different, configurations of whatever individual archetypes add up to comprise a self in any given moment, right?
Right, so I find people are singular. They do have a bias, and they're continuous if they're Westerners. And they project that on me. They take one aspect of me and say, that's what you are. You're a fraud. You're this, you're that. They don't even notice my changeability. And they don't know how to be changeable in public. They can be changeable at work, you know, talk one way if they're a teacher, talk one way with
but
a student, talk
they
another,
lack,
way with another student.
Yes, they lack any sort of transcendent consistency of identity across these changes, and they lack the awareness that these changes are taking place because the consistency lays within the interrelation of the logic of their typographical knowledge.
Yeah, do you get that, Susanna?
Can you repeat that, Clinton?
Oh, that's the test. Let's see if Clinton can repeat it. Repeat that, Clinton.
So these people, so people are different in different circumstances, and yet they don't have any sort of transcendent, prolonged awareness, which is constant, which transcends each of these different personalities, and they lack the self-awareness to know that they are different people at different times because they cling to a consistency over time which lays entirely within the symbolic, logical, typographical Western self. So long as they are logically consistent, they don't care that they're being angry in their arguments one day and they're being nice in their arguments the next day depending on the circumstance. They're oblivious to how the environment is modulating their message, which remains the same.
Right. That was pretty good, Susanna. He pretty well said what he said.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, but you're saying that the average person is not aware of how they change their...
They can't see themselves like they're the other guy in the room looking at themselves going, what an asshole! Because their ESP prevents them from ever being the sort of asshole that they would notice them being.
Yeah.
And whereas Bob is saying most people are... Well, no. I mean, do people stay consistent? You're saying that they think they're consistently the same.
They're consistent in their logic. They're reciting the same book today as they recited yesterday. They're being consistent in their typographical, logical Western arguments. However, they won't, as Bob and apparently Ion prescribe, they won't go be the asshole they fear they are so they can actually face themselves as the asshole in the eyes of everyone else going, oh my god, you're such an asshole. They won't go be the fullness. They won't express the fullness of their flawed nature for their own naked observation so they can stand there and go, oh my god, this is who I am. They act. And in that self-deception, in that avoidance of being their full selves, lies the duplicity of being a narcissist who shapes their image. Rather, in love with their image of themselves as always being the right person at the right time, which is consistent in their mind, but which is inconsistent in who they act from moment to moment as the environment pulls them out of it.
But they can't be an observer of their own behavior.
Yeah, they can't be an observer of their own behavior.
Well, they have the dualistic good-bad thing. They are taught, which is based on fear, they're still trying to be good to some authority or something they respect. You know, that's part of the pagan artistic doctrine is they want you, you'll see a lot of movies do this from artists, they show a person get alienated and then becomes a dropout or a prostitute or something. They go into the underground. And that's an archetype. And they become bad. And then there's a whole reaction of their former colleagues about them becoming, quote, bad. That's going from the darkness to the light or the light to the darkness. A balanced person doesn't have that dialectic. They've included a little bit of the darkness and the light all the time in themselves.
That's what Jordan Peterson is always trying to get at with the incorporation of the shadow. And the awareness that you could be an Auschwitz guard. Right? He's always trying to warn people, hey, you are exactly the sort of person who could become a Nazi in the right circumstance, right? And that's what his whole Jungian shtick is about, is embracing that.
So he's using visual Gutenberg values to counter the Gutenberg bias. Because the Gutenberg bias makes you want to be all good and not bad. Because the black and white of print makes you think there's a big positive and a big negative.
Yeah.
Now, he's trying to get you not to be so split from the Gutenberg effect and recognize the black part of yourself is also in your consistency. And he probably doesn't do a good job, from my point of view, in doing that because he doesn't show the environmental grounds of it. But he does show the conceptual guys like Jung and other people. That's his conceptual ideal of someone who knows how to include the dark side of themselves.
Right, right. The mechanics, the dynamics... at a very tight level aren't there, but the broad strokes of what should result are painted out. You should be able to look back at your life and see you've been doing it this way. That's what the conceptual gives you.
Yeah.
It doesn't give you the dance moves in the now. Yeah.
And, I was going to say, like, I always know that people... who like me for a while or learn from me will rebel against me, will get mad at me. That always will happen. And I used to say on the radio show back in the day in the 80s, 90s, they said, I really like your stuff, Bob. You're a really good guy. I said, well, watch out. You will turn on me eventually. And they, oh, no. You're a great guy. No, you will turn on me. And they all do.
You jerk. One day.
Yeah.
Coming, Bob.
Yeah. So.
And why is that? Why do you? What is your explanation for that? That
oh, it's just it's blind faith in his word today. I just take in total faith that he must be right because I love him so much. So obviously, if he says I'm going to turn on him, then I just you know, okay, fuck you, Bob, from me in the future, predated.
Right now.
Postdated.
Now here's the reason. Here's my answer to that. Because we're all gods, and we don't like to be duped, reality does dupe us, so we become a passive student. And in a way, it's humiliating. And then once you've learned the lesson, you've got your confidence back, you're not into being the passive consumer of whoever you were paying your respects to, so you have to reassert your independence, which you got suckered into losing for a minute.
Well, it's a
rebel, and you get mad, and you reassert your independence. Say, Bob was good, but he doesn't know this, and I've learned that.
Yeah.
Now Peterson is more important.
Yeah,
you know?
They reassert
their individuality.
It's a renegotiation of the relationship between the two individuals, which started off on such an uneven keel, right?
Right. A natural uneven. And that's not a problem. They have to do that. They have to reassert their independence of you, and that's natural. It's part of the growth. But they are usually all emotionally involved in it, and I'm not.
Well, there you go. So therefore, you are defeating the physics or the inertia of where one person leapfrogging off of you pushes you down.
Yeah, I'm defeating that, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah.
By being so detached. Well, do you get the gain of the love to begin with for it to be lost later?
Yeah, and then they if they're lucky, they come back.
Well, if you're lucky. If they're lucky.
No, I don't particularly care. I got enough good friends as it is. I don't need any more. I do get more, but I don't require them. It's like the basic thing is that most people require a deep, loving relationship at some point in their life so they have, as Alan Parsons said, someone in whom they can trust.
Uh-huh.
That's a deep need in everybody.
Uh-huh.
So if you've loved and been loved, you're pretty detached after that.
Right, right. Having received that.
And you'll see most people who never get that, they're pretty neurotic. Like Susanna, I could say, is vulnerable to that because she never had a loving relationship.
Well, yes, and people who try to provide that to themselves are narcissistic. It's a short circuit closure. So what?
They become, fanatic about some angle. They become specialized.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
So you see that, Susanna? So you're making yourself look younger, so you're going to get that love. That love's coming, Susanna.
Yes, that's why my only unbalanced part of my life right now.
Right, and it's the deepest part, and that's the key part. Yes. And you, I don't know if it's unbalanced, but you haven't been able to be your full self.
Yeah, true. I would agree.
So how does media allow transformations in what was pre-technologically a purely human sort of love?
You're saying, can we get it with our five bodies?
Yeah.
That's a big question. I don't know. I think a lot of the younger people over the last couple of generations have been adjusting to not requiring that. And we don't know if that'll work, because if everything gets shut off, then you're back to the chemical body scale again.
Ooh, yeah.
That
yes.
Need will come back.
Yes, yes. What, like, I mean...
Well, as long as we keep going into the matrix, people are going to be able to, as McLuhan said, as long as the music's playing, everything's okay.
Well, what about,
and as predicted...
What about Marilyn Monroe as a canary in the coal mine?
Right. In this assassination book, they have a picture I've never seen before, Marilyn Monroe, sort of like in a party with both Kennedy brothers talking to her, and it looks like a very serious discussion. She doesn't have a happy look in her face. And, they eventually murdered her. And it was like a picture where they're saying, look, what you're saying about us is not cool. You gotta back off.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm projecting what I know about it. But, she was our canary in this situation of charisma. Because if you're doing well and you're still making music and making money, you can have a surface life like Madonna does. You know, fucks anything that moves or whatever she does. She runs around. Can she handle when it's taken completely away from her?
Uh-huh.
That's the drama. So as long as this virtual reality matrix keeps going, everybody's going to adjust and they'll become like Woody Allen's movie The Sleeper. You ever seen that? It's called Sleeper.
Yeah, with the giant banana. That's what I remember. It was a comedy. I've seen it.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Well, yeah, remember when they would go into the orgasmatron?
Yeah.
All right? So nobody had any relationships.
Yeah.
They just put themselves in the machine and have an orgasm. So now the media is tending towards that. And as long as that's the environment, then you'll be a fully liberated young lady, and you have fun with all your bodies, and Kindle or whatever, that Tinder it all up and all that stuff people do, occasionally dropping out and becoming married, have a few kids, kick your husband out, raise the kids, and then go back to Tindering. So Madonna's acted out a lot of that. So if the media environment is there to support that, okay, but you're really vulnerable. And if you actually wake up and say, wait a minute, like Neo, I'm inside an environment getting altered by default. Where should I go? If you can't get a solution to that, you'll get cancer and kill yourself.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, so that's the dilemma for all of us as we go more virtual. which is well expressed in Ion's argument with that futurist about that.
That's Bob. My way out of that was there's a couple that I avoided fiction. I stopped watching television. I stopped reading fiction books. B, I eschewed numerology and any sort of woo and any sort of unscientific things. And then I spent a year and a half rebuilding reality. As soon as I started to think I'm getting red-pilled, I accepted that there's no way that my perception will reveal the truth to me merely by lifting the wool from my eyes. You have to build reality. And
right.
I started work at building it while pulling out every possible contaminant to the construction project of reconstituting my perception from the ground up. So, like, you can do it. I just happen to know how to do it when it started because I had pre-knowledge or whatever. But as soon as you start to fall out of the matrix, you got to start building a reality out of raw, hard-earned research, carefully selected with the most tightest scrutiny of what you're incorporating into your new perception, right? Hell, you
right.
yourself are a huge risk incorporating into my perception, but I took that risk because you're pretty cool in the end.
Yeah.
But,
In the end, I'm pretty cool. I may be on the way, tough taskmaster, but, in the long run, I'm not malicious. I'm not trying to hurt you.
Yeah, I feel that. I certainly couldn't think
but
it could...
But even still, you could be in the Matrix, you can be in the virtual world, and be aware of it, and...
Well, that's what he's going to balance. He's got to go extreme rebuilding himself as he starts it. Then he'll be able to drop it after he gets it, and then jump back into the illusion, or whatever you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
The darkness, and then know he can rebuild himself. Hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. Yeah. Hopefully, a sort of resilience in that regard is the end goal. Yeah.
And it's probably, like Ian says, it never stops. That's what's fun, is that you don't get to the finish point. You just get better at it.
Well, if I could name all the mountains that I'm never going to climb, then I still know a whole bunch of geography, right?
Yep. And Ian, here we are talking about parallel worlding in a recent session back 8-9 years ago, and Ian's saying the ascended person is happy wherever they are, even in a less than position.
Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Did someone else come in there? Did you do all that, Suzanne, or did someone else?
Yeah, that was me. I remember that thing. It's not about going to other worlds. It's just being happy. And
right.
Just, I forget how they said it, but it was like, yeah.
So something like that. And if you, they didn't say this, but it implied, if you can relax on that point, you'll suddenly be, by default, almost sent to other worlds. See, that's how you get to these new things. You can't be wanting them. You can't be working your ass off to get there. You'll just frustrate yourself.
Oh, that's everyone who's too direct at what they want. I need to be spiritual, so they study spiritualism. Like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I got spiritualism out of reading computer textbooks, because that's what I was interested in, right? And I inferred all the things. You can't run directly at your target, or you'll run directly into the first freaking snake oil salesman who's standing there, who reserved that domain name and has that search engine fucking, you know, gamed. Yeah, people who go looking for...
I was just some secret guy who taped the past hour or two. It was a very good conversation.
I mean, yeah, me too. Yeah.
Maybe they'll show up and send it to you. I sometimes think that Mateo tapes a lot of this stuff. You know, out there in Tacoma. But we haven't heard from him for a few months.
Unofficial archivist. Well, is there any...
Right. I mean, he knows the tape, but he knows it's good, but he doesn't want us to know it is being taped, so he just shuts up and tapes it and doesn't tell anybody. But it's there when Bob realizes it could be sold, a lot of money could be made from it, then he'll release them.
Mm-hmm. There you go. I have faith in the greed of capitalists, so you never know.
Right. Now, remember what you're going to say. Now, did you see what I did there? I was there talking like an ostensible serious thing, then I veered off into a super ironic greed thing. That's the way I do my humor. I'm going along, and you think I'm talking this way, and all of a sudden I'll slip into the opposite modality, right?
Right.
That makes you laugh. That's
nimble.
Why you laugh there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Because you're being funny.
Yes. Well, you didn't know it was coming, and then all of a sudden I switched the intent of what you thought the direction it was going in.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So
very
humor.
Witty.
Yes, the humor is often pulling the rug out. You know, it's a shock. So that's what I can do verbally.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Bill played some audio at the very beginning of the show from Ion, and I'm screaming, Rob, Rob's talking. I'm trying to get him to listen to me. I go, what, Rob, about 20 times. That was a funny little excerpt, but it would have seemed like I was crazy. Rob wasn't going to listen to me, but I didn't care that I sounded crazy, and I just kept yelling, Rob. So I like this line. Who am I talking to? Clinton. McLuhan says every joke has a grievance. Well, there's a new kind of humor that comes out of interacting with Ion, because Ion's a new phenomenon, a new technology. So it creates new grievances, and it creates a different kind of humor.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Would you say that? Do you agree with that, Susanna?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, I was going to ask you.
Yeah, what? You were going to say something. Did you forget?
No.
Good. Go ahead.
Can I go on now? Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about Alan Cabal. Have you kept up with that? What's happening?
Oh, yeah, I check in every week, and for about 3 or 4 weeks, he has not written. Now, he did a sign-off thing. I think his last column was something like, boy, when Trump gets elected, his second term is going to be a doozy. He said something like that. And he predicted Trump the first time, so now he's predicting Trump will get back in. But either he's gotten real sick, or he took off to Finland. He has some fans in Finland, and they're offering to put him up or something. But yes, he has, unless the heat in Florida is really bad, he just can't function. But yeah, I don't know. He's gone into a mystery zone.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, just, he's really a good writer. He's very clear what he writes.
Yeah.
And
he's good at grievance. He's entertaining at his grievances.
He's such grievance, and
yes.
Very much so. And then, but it seems like he seems so intelligent. It's like, why isn't he in touch with you, Bob, and with the product?
Well, because he basically doesn't have grace. See, he's a kid who doesn't have, now we come full circle. He's a guy who doesn't have grace. He's been a fuck up ever since he was a child actor. And he's been in the underground, and he's good at it, but there's an underlying cynicism and hatred of humans, and he says that about himself. He says, lucky I have marijuana, or else I would have been a serial killer. He's got some grievance against humanity and life, and that's what he makes good writing, but personally, it's not good for him. And so he's stuck, and it's frozen his body into a really bad sickness of an underlying anger in him.
Uh-huh.
And he may have, because I was focusing on him and reading him religiously for the last, 3 years, I fucking get to him on the non-physical level. I think he's collapsed under the Bob gaze.
Oh, wow. It's like
but
the...
you did reach out to him, didn't you?
Yes, I sent our discussing his stuff for months, and he never responded. I don't know if it got to him. And then on his on the column, when you go to the website, it has a place where you can make a comment, but it wouldn't let me type. So I wondered if he blocked me or it's just not done properly. The machine's broken. So I never could tell him, hey, pay attention here. Never could get to him. Tried different ways.
But there were
and
some
so,
things that he wrote about that you could tell he was listening to. He was,
you would think
he
that. Well, he had the same
archives.
Interest. He had the same... encyclopedic view of the underground. That's what I liked about him. He knew a lot of things. He probably even knew about Mae Brussel. You know, he knew, took in a lot of stuff. He was attentive to a lot of subcultures like I was, and that's why I liked, I knew what he was referring to in his writing all the time. But he has either taken a conscious break or he got broken. So we'll see.
I guess. It just amazes me how there are so many people that should be
who miss the
in
boat,
this environment
the boat.
And are not here, exactly. I just,
well, they don't
I
have grace. They don't have grace. They didn't have the luck. They don't have the luck to get there. Most people are don't have grace for whatever reason. You can get theological, say it's original sin, or it's the disservice of being a child in a family.
Yeah. Interesting. Yep.
You know, in my life, I've always been relating to just a couple of people. I've always had good friendships with a couple of people for a while, and then the circumstances would change, and I'd meet another couple of people. So I've always had an audience of one or two people, you know, for 60, 70 years. And I always think that's a good way to do it. Because if we had a million listeners, what would be the point? You know, Peterson's worried about. He's smart enough to know this could be a tragedy, you know. He knows it's getting beyond his scale. So what is going to happen to his communications? What's the point of them?
Which is why he's focusing more and more on the medium. He's saying, hey, look, well, that's the thing. People are, the critics, not his fans, but they're criticizing the intellectual dark web on how they spend half their time talking about how civil their conversations are and how what role models they are for having such civil conversations despite being so disagreeable with one another. They're trying to spread the medium of their civil discourse above and beyond the content of their particular disagreements on any given issue.
You know, and that's the heart of liberalism. McLuhan predicted that liberalism will flip into conservatism. And this book, really great book, The Great War and the Language of Modernism, is all about how the British liberal government lied all through World War I based on the liberal principle of tolerance and being reasonable. But they didn't realize verbal reason had been obsolesced by the new media. So this is a student of McLuhan who doesn't bring in any McLuhan, but he's making the same point with his history, his scholarship. But what you just said is the problem. And what did you just say? Break this in, I can't remember.
They are rising above the medium of their style of discourse as
How tolerant they are.
Agreeable yet
yes,
friendly.
See, that's the liberal dream.
Yes. Oh, yes.
We can discuss these issues reasonably.
Yes.
We don't become mock minds. You know, yelling at everybody else. You fucking express your
grief. Yes, and they're becoming more explicit about how words which are vitriolic and spiteful, and how even the most heated of mediated, either orally or typographically, is not stabbing each other with a fucking sword, right? As long as the fights, as vicious as they are relegated to the, you know, chip body.
Words won't break your bones.
Yes, exactly. So, hey guys, we need free speech so that people can fight it out as visually as possible in a mediated form to abstain from chemical body violence. Yeah. That's the point.
Yeah,
that
he's trying to, and he's celebrating chemical body articulation, that you are able to engage strange ideas, ones you don't instinctively like, and talk about them and argue with them or agree with them or learn from them.
He can bring that
That's
in.
That's the liberal, literate,
but there's a caveat here. Peterson grew up in rural Alberta, and for men, he always brings in the threat of physical violence into the peace-seeking heuristic for communication, he always says that when two men are arguing with each other and they get louder and louder and louder, the very real threat of one of them punching the other in the face is precisely what allows the conversation to maintain its earnestness and its fullness. And it, as long as you maintain that threat of physical violence, you can end up peaceably, agreeably reaching a common ground, because two people negotiate in their, two masculine men negotiate in their real, very real threat of fucking killing each other. They'll talk each other back down and reach a common ground. But with a woman, where you're not allowed to hit her, the woman is like a crazy bitch harpy who can, like, take over the man, and the man's not allowed to hit her, and men are helpless in our fights with women because they can't do anything because they are morally obligated to not have that threat of physical violence. So the restriction from any sort of chemical body reaction as a fallback eliminates a man's ability to argue with women. And that's, like, the biggest reason he gets called a sexist, is because everyone's like, what? Peterson's saying that, like, men aren't allowed to punch women, and so, like, what the fuck, right? And, yeah, he
wait, I'm not sure I get that. That's why he gets people liking him, did you say?
Well, no, he's a sexist because he thinks two men can argue it out, because the ever looming threat of physical violence as a sword of Damocles prevents it from getting out of hand. Whereas a woman can be the biggest, shrillest, harpiest, most manipulative bitch in the world, and the guy can't,
do anything about it.
Yeah, yeah. And so women
and
win,
women,
and that's why feminism is cancer.
Yeah. Where they don't have that stigma.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what is your point here, that he is losing on that point? Or
my point is that he has a holistic, multi-bodied model only for men in a patriarchal society, but he doesn't know how women fit into the picture if you can't bring the threat of violence into your day-to-day negotiation with another person as two individuals as a last-case fallback measure.
Right, so that's why the evolution of his image and those things have been realized. They go, okay, well, let's check out how he's with his wife. How does that? What is that? What do they do? That's probably why that's this week's examination of
his
image.
His wife,
going into the wife aspect.
His wife says that she tested him to make sure. His wife really didn't want to marry a pussy. Like, his wife was like, I don't want to marry a pussy, so I tested him to make sure he was a strong man, and when I knew he was, I married him. So his wife is very traditional in that regard. So, like,
right,
she wanted a strong
guy. Okay, so here's, right, so here, we know that Bob and Carol solve all these problems. We're the ultimate fucking model of a male-female relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have products to sell. They don't have shit to sell. They just got ideas. They don't have food. We offer new foods.
Yes, he's selling he's selling tools for people to construct new life narratives. His future authoring, past authoring suite. He is selling shit. A personality test, a method to write your life down in a biography in a very typographical sense and project your logical.
Still within psychology and ideas.
Yes.
No one's marketing alchemy and foods like we are. But
true.
What is it I'm going to say about me and Carol? What do we got? I think it's because she can live without me with her career and all that she does. I can live without her without all that I have. So most couples aren't like that. A couple is one depend on the other, either male or female. Now, the millennials, if they get jobs, they can be by themselves. They don't need the coupleness for support. That was the long-range economic effect of women's lib. But then they are isolated, and they don't have an intimate interaction. So I don't know where to say beyond that. I'm just saying that Carol and I are a model for what he may not be able to do. You can't accuse me of being hoiking up the male side of things, because I've always said I'm a woman.
Hmm.
So I know the woman's side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't get limited. Knowing the woman's side maybe gets to media analysis, like McLuhan got.
Yeah.
But being left hemisphere guy, he can't get to that point.
Right, but he has done the extensive. Okay, he was so terrified by the potential for nuclear war during the Cold War that he read enough books to have all the concepts that when he, you know, entered acoustic space, he was able to do what you were saying. regarding Norman Mailer, etc., etc.
Right. But yeah. See, you couldn't. You could find occasions in me where I sound like a macho guy, but other times you won't see that. Matter of fact, I'm feminine and silly and giggly, more than he would ever be. So I can be very unmasculine.
And you're straight. So heck, yeah.
I'm straight?
I think so.
Oh, yeah, hetero. Oh, no, I brag my bisexuality. I celebrate, you know, when a gay guy comes on and starts accusing me of being hetero, I say, I fucking more gay than you. I fuck more guys, more bums than you ever will. So I'll do that. And I also say I'm trisexual. I fuck animals. No,
yeah.
I'm ready with all kinds of ammunition.
Okay. I will ask the chemical body Bob, and then we'll find out the difference here.
Right. You ask me. You meet me privately. Say, Bob, will you fuck me? That'll be an important moment.
I hope I get someone to record it. All right.
Yeah. But I was gonna another point there about the animals and okay. So you said straight, hetero. I lost it. There was another subtlety there. So
men. We're talking about men being men.
Okay, it just what, you know, I think Jeff Peterson seems to have a sense of humor. I noticed him sort of laughing at silly moments every now and then, but he's very intense and too serious with his interviewers. Like, he's staring at them, like, ready to get punched or something.
Well, when you are flung by the maelstrom, when you are the most cylindrical thing in the whole fucking maelstrom, and you get flung above the surface of the water into the sky on some sort of water spout, which is what happened to him. He got inverse maelstromed and fucking, you know, like apotheosized by electronic media. So yeah, he's taking it very, very, very seriously, as though he were a mortal trying to fill God's shoes in the meantime, in the interim.
Right.
Before the fuck he's accidental fucking, you know, John the Baptist announcing the ever coming soon to you audiences around the mass media world return of fucking Jesus Christ, right? I think that's the role
right.
The level of seriousness.
Bob, he's advocating for me.
Yeah, well, see, yeah, so in the abstract, emotionally, I think that's what he's going through as a guy, a, you know, amateur theologian, professional clinical psychologist / 30-year university lecturer suddenly finding his classroom blown up from 30 students to like 300 million students overnight.
Okay.
You know, that's the pressure.
Right. So, Clinton, I said this to someone a couple weeks ago, where since universities are obsolete, now we come back to Zingroni's idea. We always resonate back if we talk long enough of what we said 2 hours ago. So University Information Society, obsolescence of the university. So we're watching the crack-up of an academic.
Yeah.
And so he's been supernovaed, and he knows it, and he's worried, he's nervous about he's a sign of obsolescence. So when you're obsolescent, you become prominent. So the academic syndrome, because I heard him say he's trying to start another university, so he's trying to figure out to answer his dilemma of the obsolescence of a one learned mind against the global Black Mirror chatter that's going on 24/7, which is another form of education.
So
we're watching a crack-up, and he knows it, and he doesn't know where it's going to end.
By
now, McLuhan,
Black Mirror,
was
you
more detached about it. See, this is what you got. McLuhan had silly humor in this thing that
doesn't
do. So McLuhan is more detached. He doesn't matter if it goes bad. He's still got his teaching and still relating one-on-one with people. But this is all, like you say, shocked Peterson. So we're watching a guy learn the pitfalls of a situation.
If he was less serious, he would do better and prolong his odds.
Yeah.
By being more
but
human.
But he is scared. And then we have to go back to the guy who wrote that article, his buddy, longtime buddy at the University of Toronto, wrote that article a couple months ago saying, I'm worried about him. He's going to become a fascist leader.
Right.
I'd like to know what that guy thinks now, because Jordan hasn't fallen into the trap, I don't think, that his friend predicted for him. Yet, not yet.
He's writing a new book, 12 More Rules. He's going to be taking a break after a few more months of his nonstop tours. He's taking a very long break. It's pre-scheduled. Everyone already knows when it's going to be, so they won't be surprised. He's painted
he's
an arc.
Media fast.
Yes, well, no, as the planning, goal-oriented person who thinks he can anticipate the future and knows how to plan it in advance, we're like, okay, if we all get nuked tomorrow, his plans get blown out the window. But nevertheless, he has to act as though the future is predictable and you can orient yourself as an individual within the predictable, steady, you know, long-term future so that your plans might actually come to fruition, because that's the only way to get anything done that takes longer than a few hours to complete, right? So,
yeah.
As that sort of mindset of, oh yeah, don't worry, the ground we're all walking on in the 21st century is totally stable, so you can totally make plans that last like 5 years, and 5 years from now you'll totally get to what you plan to, or something equivalent, right? Like, he's acting like that's real.
Right, and what's your point, though, then?
If that holds up, then, he's painted his exit, and he's making for his beeline of just when he's at his wit's end and his rope is at this fucking end. He's already got his exit planned, and he's going to take a few months to relax.
So you think his friend's prediction will not realize? Will not
right. Realize. I think he has the comfort of this countdown of knowing, okay, it's only 3 more months of flying around, showing up at random theaters and entertaining crowds of 10,000 people and staying for 4 hours to sign autographs for my VIPs, taking photographs. He's monetized everything. He's getting the money. He's being rewarded, right? People are paying money to stay late. He's getting money. He's got 4 more months. It's going to fund his future university. It's going to fund his next book. It's going to fund his children's fucking education. He's got all the incentives in the traditional, you know, bean counter sense to be like, I can stick through this and I can act like a fucking prophet for...
Now, here's the point. Bob's lurking, Bob being a metaphor for Iondom.
Yes.
What ions cause the planet, will he be ready for that unforeseen shit that's going to happen?
Well,
yeah.
From his perspective, that would just be the chaos of the moment. And
he could handle
it. He's prepared insofar as he knows that at any time his wave could collapse and he could fall back into the maelstrom, yes. He's only prepared in a general sense of anticipating that no matter how smart you are, the human mind is a frail, mere object that is utterly impossible of modeling the complexity of all of reality. He knows that much. That's what he teaches. He just doesn't have the multifaceted, technologically deterministic media septifurcation? Five bodies? A septifurcated fucking model that you do.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he maybe just got basic bifurcation.
Yeah, chaos and order, and you walk the line.
Right, I think sept is seven, it would be sync, C-I-N-Q, isn't that five?
Okay, syncificated, yeah.
Yeah, syncificated, right. Okay, well, that's very good, we had a very good discussion. Hey, Susanna, wasn't that good?
Yeah, it was really good.
Okay, but so I got to go... What?
Oh, I need to go too. I was going to say, I need to hit the hay.
Right. So, very good, Clinton. So, come back next week. We'll pick it up.
Absolutely. See you guys in a week. Thanks, Susanna. Thanks, Bob. Who else is here?
All right. Thank you.
Great. All right. Talk
very
to you guys
good.
Later.
Bye.
Bye. Well, I hope somebody taped it. Okay. Bye.
All right.
Talk
bye-bye.
Bye.
I taped it.